What's up, everyone, and welcome to SmashPad.com's first ever end of the year podcast. I'm Daniel Victorio, alongside Filippo Donolfo, Pat Mifflin, Chris Elogi, Brandon Perkins, and Teresa Sammons. How y'all doing?
We're good.
Hey.
Good.
So far, so good.
Yep.
All right, so like I said earlier, this is the first time we're ever doing this. We've done the Game of the Year stuff via editorial for quite a few years now, but this is the first time we're actually doing a formal podcast. So in this show, our staff is pretty much just going to look at the year 2017 and what a year it's been.
For better or anybody worse, have it? It's been a year.
Mm-hmm. Game for game, I think it's been one of the better ones.
Yeah.
I think, by and large, we're really starting to see the industry-wide effort to let go of their dependence on AAA titles.
Yeah, and part of that was helped by the rather spectacular implosions of some of them.
Yes.
From, you know, basically the one that's continuing right now, which is the loot box fiasco. Stuff like the sort of underwhelming, responses to games like Mass Effect Andromeda, things like, just all in all, that this sort of annualizing certain franchises has really just sort of diluted what made some of those franchises so good to begin with, that it's basically just, you know, nobody really even cares now. I mean, some of them still sell really well, but, you know, they sell for the same reason that, you know, Madden sells every year.
Yeah.
You just don't ever want to give people the opportunity to question whether what they do is out of habit or passion.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a different industry now. You know, we see gaming move more towards being a service rather than, you know, just something for people to just play and enjoy.
I think that's the next demon we have to slay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. So first off, we're just going to go a little bit over our awards. The way SmashPad does it is a little bit different from everybody else. First of all, we have a small staff. So we had about a panel of 12 people who want to participate. Go ahead and name anywhere from 5 to 10 of their favorite games this year. Each game is given a certain amount of points. So, for example, my top pick of the year would receive 10 points, whereas my 10th best game would receive 1. And then you go ahead and move along the board, and the higher it is, the more points you get. It's not perfect, especially since, you know, not everybody here has every console. Not everybody here has the time to go ahead and play every great game there is. But at the end of the day, we're pretty proud of our list, and that'll be posted on January 1st of next year. And yeah, it's been a heck of a year, and we've also come across some interesting stats here. Like, for example, there's 2 games in our top 10 that received 7 nominations from our staff members. Those games are Horizon Zero Dawn and Sonic Mania, both of which actually achieved top spots on a few of our lists. And yeah, they're games that we believe do warrant attention. So first, I want to go ahead and talk about Horizon. I know, Brandon, you actually just finished it, right? So what are your thoughts?
Yeah. So Horizon essentially, okay. So I think we need to kind of go back first about when Horizon originally debuted at E3. Mm-hmm. And everybody's first sort of impression was, what was everybody's first impression?
Robot dinosaurs.
Okay.
For me, it wasn't really much the Zelda thing. I just thought it was pretty fucking cool that we'd be taking down robots with bows and arrows. No matter how stupid that sounds, yeah, it's just awesome.
Yeah. And for the record, yes, you still did that in the game, too. So there was no, you know, it's not like they took anything back or anything. Also, there was the fact that, you know, you had a strong female protagonist that was not sexualized in any particular fashion, which I think is you know, something that is, you know, I'm not against having sexy female protagonists as long as that's, you know, not their sole character trait. But, you know, Aloy feels like a holistic character. And, you know, her struggle and her sort of overall story arc is really kind of the heart of the game. What also impressed me really was the story, the actual story of the game. It essentially is a post-apocalyptic scenario, but it gives a pretty good and pretty reasonable post-apocalyptic scenario, and it does a good job of sort of tying up a bunch of loose ends, like why exactly is it that, you know, there was so much information from the past lost, or, you know, why, you know, what about all these different AIs, and, you know, what happened to all the other survivors and all this stuff. But also really what really got me was the gameplay. This game, the gameplay for this game was so solid. It did something I didn't think was possible, which it took what is in many ways a sort of third person shooter type gameplay and restricted it purely to, well, not necessarily purely, but mostly to archery. And the archery was so good, and it was so easy to use. It did require a little bit of a learning curve at first, because there was a lot of you know, being able to tell your trajectory and, you know, having a sort of sense of, you know, when to loose the string and not. But
also
overall,
do a good job of giving you like information, like here's potential weak points. This part's weak to fire. This part's mm-hmm. weak to ice. That sort of stuff, and gives you a lot of tools to strategize for how you're going to tackle, you know, the bigger enemies.
Yeah. Also, the one other thing good is that there is no scare. It has okay. So one of the things in this game is that you have to make sure to sort of gather your resources. You know, arrows require wood, and certain arrows require certain kinds of wood. Also, it requires certain types of rock or metal, and certain materials to create, to, you know, modify your various arrows and how to use them. And the good thing is, there's no shortage of them, of these materials. Those materials are basically everywhere.
I mean, gathering resources sucks. It always sucks. But with Horizon, you don't even know you're doing it, because everywhere you're running, there's shit to get.
And that's especially bad for anybody who's borderline OCD like I am, because
oh no.
Yeah. Bad part of that with Horizon is it'll highlight things as red if you can't pick it up. There's a certain distance where everything shows is like green. Mm-hmm. So I'm always like, oh, there's something over there, and I get closer and it's like, oh, it's red. Mm-hmm. That's the one negative thing about that. It's like, oh, is that some health thing, or is that, you know, some wood I can pick up, or is that, you know, some other stuff I could use? Like, no, oh crap.
Yeah. Honestly, the only issue I ran into with the whole looting situation was just running out of spaces to even have stuff. You know?
Yeah, that was the one thing. It's like your storage is finite, and so mm-hmm. like if there is one sort of negative to it, is that you do have to, you know, have to get resources to expand your storage. And,
yeah, because you have like the more generic stuff, like the wood or the rocks or that sort of stuff, mm-hmm. that fills up probably more of your inventory than when you find like the specialized stuff.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, this, I'm only going to have like a couple of these, so I need to go drop like this bundle of wood because fuck, I can get wood everywhere.
Yeah. I'll also say that there is a point in this game where if you've played smart enough, you become so flush with currency and resources that it does. I don't want to say the game beats itself, but it kind of beats itself.
I mean, if you mess.
I was just going to say, you get to a point where you're no longer worrying about the minutiae, because you're so flush with resources. It's like, okay, whatever. Let me just do what
I need
to do.
And to be honest, there is kind of a virtue to that, because there's a point in this game where you're going to want to be sure that you have resources with you, because there are parts, you know, in the second half where it's kind of easy to be overwhelmed if you're not playing smart. And that's another thing about this game that I really loved. It actually had some really good, some really solid, like, close combat and stealth mechanics as well. Which is especially needed when you go into like an enemy enclave, because those things are packed with enemies that could kill you at a second if you're not smart. And
They kind of borrowed a lot of ideas from Far Cry, but do them a lot better, because there's obviously a lot of stealth in Far Cry, but being in first person, it's always hard to tell when you're, you know, well hidden or not, and get a good sense of the space around you, as well as just having like the in Far Cry, like there's always the potential of animals to come out of nowhere and attack you. Whereas here, generally, you have a better idea of where everything is at, because you have that sort of the thing you push the is it the right stick in that brings up the big thing that lets you analyze everything that's around you.
Mm-hmm. Basically, it's which by the way, that's that particular I wanted to bring up the artifact that you know she that Aloy attaches to her head. Really neat way of sort of integrating the game's UI into the overall gameplay and the universe. I also say that, and we talked a little bit about, you know, the archery and the combat. One of the things I also really loved is the fact that, you know, basically every enemy type has a different way of having to approach and conquer it. You know, the small ones, of course, like especially starting out with the small ones, you know, like the Watchers, which are like the generic sort of small enemy in this game. You know, that's not human. You know, starting out, you know, you learn that, you know, okay, so I can, maybe I can hit them with one shot if I'm lucky, or I can sneak up and take them out in one hit or a couple of hits. But then you get up to the bigger ones, like the big,
just like the lockjaw.
The lockjaw, the big gigantic. And at killing machines, those require a little bit more strategy and call things like, you know, finding ways to restrain them, take out pieces of them to try and reveal their weak point, and then finally taking them down, period. And those are some really intense battles, because it can go wrong so fast if you're not careful.
Yeah. I got to the big city, it was fun to see some of the sandboxy elements where there are sort of soldiers going out patrolling, like when they run into some of these big guys, especially like the flying one. And it's like, oh, I'm just going to sit here and see what happens. Maybe take some pop shots. Though I don't always know if I'm going to get XP out of that if I don't get like the killing blow. There's like a little bit of ambiguity in that sort of thing. But for the most part, I like stumbling upon, oh, there's these like bandits that are just happen to be fighting these big, big like lockjaw or the bellowback, I think it's called.
Yeah,
big dude with the like all the explosive juice in them. It's like, oh, I'm gonna go hang out over here and see what's going on.
Yeah,
and then just
the game world is very dynamic. That's part of the fun.
The main thing that I really enjoyed from the combat is the fact that it really challenges your knowledge of the actual gameplay system. I remember when I first started, all I really did was snuck around and then like attack watchers from behind with my stick. And I even did that with the bigger enemies, and you know, it wasn't really all that effective. But if you were, you know, good enough, if you were good enough with avoiding things, you could kill pretty much everything that way. It's just really, really hard. It wasn't until I was maybe 3 or 4 into the game where I figured out how to use the purple weapons. So I had these arrows where you can just go ahead and shoot them, and they'll go ahead and tear off some of their metal to make them more more vulnerable to whatever attacks you have. And then I was like, okay, cool. And then
the one that explodes.
Yes.
It has that big zoom, boom.
It has that wonderful zoom sound when it can just rips off metal. It's freaking awesome. And there's even these trials that you can take part of that actually really show you how to use each of these weapons and stuff effectively. Like, you know, not only are you just shooting things, you can also set traps. You can use your fire arrows to give them double damage because they're burning. Things like that. And it really just challenges whatever you think you know about the system. After doing these challenges, I was like, you know what? I think I can go ahead and platinum this game, because everything you can do is pretty much put in front of you. There really isn't that much hidden. And say what you want about the whole surprise aspect, but I think that in itself just made it more playable. You know, you didn't have to have a guide in front of you because everything was already there.
Yeah. So just to sort of wrap up this discussion, because we could really go on for hours and hours on this game. Two things I want to say, which is number one, I loved the way that this game ended. I thought it wrapped up really well, and actually had a really nice ending to sort of put it all back together and bring it all back and give us a good bit of sequel bait too. Mm-hmm. But it also taught me that Guerrilla Games really is not a one trick pony, that they prove that they can actually do something other than a kind of generic first person shooter. And frankly, I think Horizon Zero Dawn is pretty much superior to any other product they've put out to date. So,
yeah, it's really nice when Sony lets their devs sort of spread their wings a bit. You could tell this was a game that they've been thinking about for a while, mm-hmm. and finally got a chance to do it. Whereas you look at like Microsoft and Coalition stuck on Gears, even though they came into the whole picture of, oh, we got this new IP. Nope, you're doing Gears. Or like 343 is stuck doing Halo. You know, they might all like doing that. It's really nice when you see those sorts of devs that kind of look like they're getting into a rut, be able to sort of try something new.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And real quick, I just wanted to ask. It's primarily us three and then Alex, who actually reviewed the game, that probably have the most knowledge of Horizon. But looking at our list here, Brandon, you actually have Horizon as seventh. Why is it so low with your praise?
Mostly because there was just so many good games that came out this year that it was kind of a draw. I
ran into that too.
And it was really just a matter of sort of a balancing act, really. So that's really my only excuse. That's basically it.
Gotcha. I was just curious. I mean, yeah. On the topic of, developers like not being one-trick ponies, that brings us to a game that has seen a lot of infamy over the years, and it looks like we've found a few people who can do it right. So let's talk about Sonic Mania. I'm going to throw the ball to Pat to give us his impressions.
Yeah, I knew going into 2017 that this was going to more than likely be on my list. Without giving away too much, I had no idea how high it was going to be. But this is what happens when a studio has a really good working formula and people want more of that formula and they finally go ahead and give it to you. Sonic has had an identity crisis for most of its existence, probably since any year that begins with the number 2. And it's nice to see them go back and make a proper standard Sonic game, even if they had to hire outside help to do it.
Yeah, because this game, that's the thing about this, is it was essentially they went to the fan community to make this. And that's pretty much what Sonic Mania is. It's a Sonic fan game given official Sega approval.
Yeah, I still say that some of the people who made Sonic Mania had previously made the best Sonic game ever in Sonic Mega Mix, which is something you should absolutely track down if you haven't at this point. It's over at sonicretro.org.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic game, 5 playable characters, and old school Sonic level design. And so I knew this game was going to be good because I played Sonic Mega Mix. And I think if you put these two games together, you have a singular, concise thought. And it's nice that Sonic Mania also kind of gave us levels that we were supposed to have in the past, but lost out on due to development crunch. And so there was that as well. And I'm just looking forward to seeing whatever's next from these guys. Hopefully they're the new Sonic team, because they really deserve to be. And I think Sega's big screw up was treating it like the appetizer for Sonic Forces, when if I was a decision maker at Sega, I would have either found a way to delay Sonic Mania until after Forces released, or I would have canceled Forces entirely.
Yeah. Yeah, you want to talk about a game that had an identity crisis. Sonic Forces just goes all over the goddamn place. Like, you really, I got to be honest, I do get sense that that game was meant to be a lot darker than it was going to eventually become.
I think the early reveal proves that.
Yeah, just the like you hear like dialogue like they've got Sonic captured and they've been torturing him for weeks, and then
nothing really happened.
Yeah.
And it says a lot. I think one of the free DLCs for it is Sanic.
Yeah.
Yep.
The
problem is the fandom is tantamount to a shit post, and this game enables it. So Sonic Mania is all the Sonic that you need for 2017. Buy it, play it, enjoy it, and just try to forget that anything else exists, because
Which
is kind of a bummer, because Sonic Forces is actually not terrible.
No, if Sonic Forces is adequate, I'm not going
to... It was built on the foundation of Generations, so there has to be some underlying quality to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, my God, there were so many bad decisions.
I do wish that the writers were allowed to have kind of their original sort of vision for that story, because I think a darker Sonic story actually would do a lot well.
Yeah.
But, just Sega, I guess, was just too concerned about the bottom line that they basically made them water it down, and that kind of sucks, because graphically it's the best looking Sonic game ever made.
Well, that says a lot.
Yeah.
Sonic games look good usually.
Yeah. But as for Sonic Mania,
as much as I want to piss on Sega and Sonic Forces, I just want to talk about why Sonic Mania is fucking awesome. I mean, like, first of all, as everyone here will say, it takes the series back to its roots.
And it
goes in between 2 and 3 in ways that are just wow. Like, you forgot those games even existed with the way this game plays. Not only do you have some old levels remixed, you have some new blood infused to each of them, along with some new levels to play and enjoy as well. Like, almost everything here plays exactly like a classic. It's super tight, and there's even like some stuff in there from other Sega games that are just totally mesmerizing. You have some Dr. Robotnik's mean machine. That's a spoiler. I'm sorry. Fuck it. I don't care.
First dies. Puyo Puyo, but
yeah, exactly. I mean, You have Sonic Spinball thrown in there as well. And, people hate it. I loved it. Like, growing up, I went from the NES to the Sega Genesis and then to the N64. So that Sega part of my life was a little bit of an outlier, but I enjoyed every minute of it. And Sonic Mania reminded me why that was so awesome. So, yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would also say that, you bring up that part with Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine. That actually, I think, is... example of one of the reasons why this game is so good is it has all of those surprises and little bits of unpredictable places you don't really expect see coming, because they're just not typical of a Sonic game. Typical in Sonic to be speeding through a level and then all of a sudden you're basically playing a match for puzzle game,
Another specific part I really, really loved. Do you guys know the oil zone from Sonic?
Was brilliant.
Yeah, I fucking hated the oil zone. So the fact that they burned it all down just made me fog.
The one that I would highlight would be the one right before that, Mirage Saloon. You know where that came from, right?
I don't, but the music was awesome.
Yeah, Mirage Saloon existed back in the early 90s. There are actually screenshots of it. I think it was in EGM. It was a previously planned zone for Sonic 2 called Dust Hill, and it was removed due to time constraints, but a couple of the screenshots survive to this day, and Mirage Saloon is basically the team that Sega assembled giving that stage back to us after all these years. So that was my favorite touch of Sonic Mania, but there are so many little things done right in this game, and if you're familiar with the history, that just enriches it.
Yeah. You played this too, Teresa, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
You played the shit out of it.
Yeah, I did. It was wonderful. But fuck the spinball stages, because I'm apparently too old. I was like, I need a controller that has a cord. What the hell is going on here?
Yeah, I will say that if this is a sort of a Like, I'm getting the idea that, okay, so obviously Sonic Mania has been a big success, and Sonic Forces, although kind of a meh game, still sold pretty well. So I'm thinking that going forward, Sega is probably going to have a sort of two-pronged approach to the Sega, to the Sonic franchise going here. You're going to have, like, the sort of big mainstream ones, and then you're going to have sort of the retro niche ones like Sonic Mania going forward. And if they're
Mania
smart...
Mania has a good sequel.
Yeah, and if they're smart, they're going to still let the sort of uplifted fan developers be in charge of the sequel as well.
I would say just keep this team together.
Yeah.
Honestly.
And I don't care if they have to go over into California and blow Ken Penders, but I want them to bring the Archie Sonic canon into this just at some point, because I know they're out there. I know that if it did happen, that game would sell like gangbusters over here, but we'll see.
Yeah.
In the meantime, we have a good Sonic. We're happy for it.
And it sold like hotcakes, man.
And it was really one of the high points of 2017.
Yeah. There's no way that they can ignore the outpouring of support that we've all given this game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anybody else have any thoughts on Sonic Mania?
I'm kind of bummed that I didn't get to spend as much time with it as I wanted to. But beyond that, yeah. Well, it's the winter, so I'll probably get more time to spend with it now.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, that and Sonic Mania is a game that you can come back to at any time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
just like those Genesis games.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, a part of what made 2017 so amazing is that we had a lot of games from older series that were just amazing. So, yeah, we have originals like Horizon, but we have a game like Sonic Mania, which I actually would say is probably the best. It's the best Sonic game to me. And then you have games like Crash that bring the series back. You have Mario Odyssey, which many people believe is probably the best in its class. You have Breath of the Wild, which also might be the best in its class. But, you know, we also have two games that are from established franchises that also placed highly on our list, but not as many people played. So the first one we're going to talk about is Wolfenstein 2, and let's just go to the guy who reviewed it. Brandon, floor is yours again.
I got to put an axe in a Nazi's head. The end.
That's all you need to know.
Well, there's the Steam review.
Yeah.
Okay, so look, I'm going to be completely upfront here. Anybody who has heard me talk about on Let's Weekend over the past just about year knows the absolute undying blood hatred that I have for Nazis. And this game was a catharsis that I desperately needed. For the record, the game itself is already really, really solid. I mean, it's great first-person shooting in action. It's got an amazing cinematic story that I think puts it on par with probably some of the best in actual legit film. But really at the heart of all of it for me was the fact that after basically seeing these assholes marching around with their tiki torches in Charlottesville and Sieg Heiling and seeing innocent people getting killed by these people, I just really wanted to put an axe in a Nazi's head just once. And the best part about this game is I got to do it several times. In fact, when I finally got to kill the bad guy of this game, I actually got to put a tomahawk into their head and then crack their skull open with it.
Well,
oh, yeah. And you also get the chance to kick Hitler in his stupid mustache. So there's also that.
Yeah.
More needs to be said?
Yeah, I mean, there's really not much more to add to it than that.
Yeah.
Other than the fact that... Yeah.
Like I was saying, the only thing that I'm going to add is because it came out so late in the year, I think that's probably one of the reasons that it didn't get more nominations on our lists.
Yeah,
it's kind of a bummer because it was a really great game, and it also came up against Battlefront 2 and Call of Duty, and I think the Call of Duty crowd still stuck with what they knew, despite the fact that the better game was right there.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, it came out the same day as Super Mario Odyssey and Assassin's Creed Origins. I mean, that's a fucking boner jam of a release date. So, you know.
Yeah. I will say one more thing. This game has probably one of my favorite characters in video gaming of all time, which is Horton Boone, a moonshining New Orleans with a priest collar, even though he's not a priest, basically drinking himself into a stupor with whiskey strong enough to eat through a table. And he's basically, if you want a good idea of who I am, just look at Horton. He's basically me aged about 30 years. So
nice.
And that's about all I can really say about Wolfenstein.
Yeah. I think to that I will just add that a lot of games...
However, one more. Yeah, sorry. Just one more thing. If there is one thing about any game that will always be a plus for me, it's when they give you a game within a game. And Wolfenstein 2 basically has the entire original Wolfenstein 3D playable within the game on an arcade machine. The only difference being that since, you know, this is a alternate universe where the Nazis win, you're basically playing a palette swap version. But it's still the original Wolfenstein 3D, and it's still good. So, yeah. And you can actually save your game. So,
yeah, I don't know if it actually...
how well that game aged.
Yeah. I don't know if it actually works, because I ran into a bug where it broke. I couldn't exit out or anything. So it's like, well, I gotta go to an older save.
Yep.
Before I transition, I believe Pat had a point to make.
Yeah, I just wanted to say there were a lot of games that got screwed over for one or two reasons, and I think one of them, like Wolfenstein, they came out too late in the year for us to really get time with them. Mm-hmm. And then there was another set of games that kind of got lost in the shuffle earlier in the year that once the heavy hitters really started coming, we kind of may not have recalled. And so
yeah,
I know looking at the list of final – the overall voting list, there were games that I would have probably put on mine, but they completely slipped my mind when the time came. So, but I think it was just a really loaded year overall. And, I think it's a testament to just how good 2017 was for gaming that, we had all these games that were just kind of on the outside looking in and yeah.
I mean, obviously, I haven't really gotten a chance to play it either. I did buy the game. It was like $35 on Black Friday, so I figured, why not? I'll go ahead and let my money speak for my actions. But yeah, Bethesda is just a company that I really want to support. They've been making killer single-player experiences for the last few years now, and they don't appear to be slowing down.
I love their Support Player One campaign.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Granted, like there's been a few issues with the company in regards to, you know, journalists getting early copies from them. But at the end of the day, at the end of the day, if it's a solid product, it's a solid product. And I'm not going to lie, though, part of what made me have this frame of mind for Bethesda was the fact that their E3 party was totally fucking awesome. But yeah, that's that.
You completely hammered for free, so I can understand.
Yeah. You know, all the free shit, turkey legs, why not? They fed the shit out of me, so I'll give them some support. Anyway, another game that is on our top 10 list, but didn't only had two nominations, was Tekken 7. And it actually is a what's it called? It's a return to form, because, you know, not a whole lot of people like Tekken 6. In fact,
or Tag 2.
Or Tag 2, so it's a good return of form for them, and I'm gonna go ahead and let Phil talk about that a little bit.
All right, so Tekken 7 was very interesting in that it stripped back a lot of the crap that had accumulated over the years in the Tekken franchise. It had basically turned into a spreadsheet, the game, where it was basically, let's count frames and... if you have less than your opponent, you're probably going to win. There is still some of that in Tekken 7. If you're going to play at a high level, there's really no way of getting around that. But Tekken 7 is a lot
more. There's more to the game now.
Yeah, there's more to the game now. It feels like they're really trying to let you intuit what a character is capable of rather than just trying to basically make you calculate it all. So there's a lot to the game in that respect. What have they done? Yeah, you know, I'm not so sure I'm thrilled about the rage arts. It's, you know, basically a super move.
Yeah.
Does hella damage. Really easy to pull off. Does it really add much to the game?
They're also really telegraphed and really punishable.
Yeah. You know, you can't...
They're fair.
Yeah, they're fair. But, you know, I don't know whether or not that's a great thing to have added, considering some of the characters basically have what amounts to super moves as regulars. So, like, you know, Akuma. So,
yeah.
Yeah. And Geese, he's got his fair share of interesting stuff that can be exploited, which they have subsequently done a lot of nerfing to. So at least Namco is paying attention to the stuff that's being, you know, developed and, you know, reacting accordingly.
Yeah, Harada's watching it like a hawk, which is good. I'm expecting similar treatment to Noctis when he drops because he looks pretty cancerous right now.
Yeah. We'll see how he turns out. They might, you know, nerf him from the start and give him the stuff that they're seeing with Geese and Akuma already. So, you know, basically for me, Tekken 7 is a game that I enjoy thoroughly because it's a game that I can play and not have to actually think about. I don't mean that the game is mindless. I mean that...
Intuitive.
It's intuitive. I can play it at a subconscious level rather than having to play it at a conscious level. And that might sound weird, but I'm pretty sure Pat knows...
I know exactly what you're saying. Yes, and I think that's when fighting games are at their best, and I think that's what makes Soul Calibur such a great series, is that that has the same thing going. And it's nice to see Namco kind of re-adopting that into their fighting game development mentality. So, here's to good things to come for them.
Yes,
and Tekken 7 is, and Tekken 7 is not done by any means. So,
nope,
lots to look forward to there.
Yeah. So that's cool. Tekken 7. You know, we both nominated it on our lists, but we're pretty much the only people who dig fighting games, so that's why Tekken 7 didn't score as high on the overall list. So
I'm happy it got into the top 10, though.
Yeah,
I really am.
I have an important question. How many people get thrown into a volcano in that game?
Jesus.
One, immediately, and then actually one more later on. Yeah, so
for people that don't know, that's like a common way to end stories in Tekken games. Oh, we just threw him into a volcano. Oh, he somehow survived that. Came back and then threw the other person in the volcano or something like
that. Like, but this time it actually concluded the whole storyline, so...
Yeah.
I don't think he's coming back.
No, not this time. So, good there.
That and I love King. Like the
wrestling. Nice.
With the Tiger My Man who runs a orphanage, all that sort of good stuff.
Yeah.
My main.
Yeah. Yeah, don't play against Pat when he's using King, unless you like using. So,
I actually just picked up Tekken 7, so I might run into that situation in a few days. We'll see.
We'll set up a room and have some
awesome
fun.
Awesome.
Smash Pat room.
But yeah, here's my question for you guys. In addition to Tekken 7, Pat also nominated Marvel vs. Capcom Infinite. But let's say you have a casual person talking to you. Where's Injustice 2? What do you think about that?
That's a really good question.
For the record, Injustice 2 did not get a single nomination from anybody here.
Nope.
Just putting that out there.
I think that NetherRealm has its audience. It knows its audience very well and does very well by its audience. The Injustice games as a whole just seem to be missing something from a design standpoint. I don't know what it is. I can't put my finger on it. But and this is coming from somebody who loves Mortal Kombat 10, Mortal Kombat 9 completely. It just feels like it's missing something that that would put it on the same level as, say, a Tekken 7 or a Marvel vs. Capcom Infinite, because I don't know what it is. I do think it's really weird for a superhero fighting game to be cut from the cloth of more down to earth fighting games like your Mortal Kombat's or your Street Fighters, rather than what we call anime fighters, which are Marvel, Capcom, Guilty Gear, Undernight, things like that. Maybe that's a direction that NetherRealm could look to in the future to maybe give Injustice more of an identity than it has. On a personal level, I wasn't really a fan of the list of characters that were cut from Injustice 2 coming from Injustice 1. So that kind of it gave me less to invest in.
Okay. That's actually really interesting to me, considering the fact that you actually just recently got back into reading comics again, right?
Off and on.
Okay.
I buy a couple of consistent series on Comixology whenever I get the chance. But I'm kind of a man without a country in that regard, because my main comic fandom is the X-Men side of the Marvel Universe, which hopefully it will start getting better now, but right now I don't really have a game to get behind in that regard, so that has been an issue. But I do think you need fighting games I think you need superhero fighting games to be more of the anime bent, and that might be maybe that's where Injustice 2 – where I'm seeing shortcomings in Injustice 2. I don't think it's a bad game or a bad series by any stretch. I just think it falls short of its competition. So I was actually kind of surprised when the Game Awards named it Fighting Game of the Year, because it just felt like there was so much more going on to Tekken 7 and to Marvel vs. Capcom Infinite if you get past the initial look of the game. And I've bashed on Marvel's aesthetics as well, because I don't like how they went all MCU with it. Mm-hmm. I also was not a fan of the effect that had on the soundtrack, because you had a lot of these characters who have had some of the best fighting game background themes of all time. And then you get to Marvel vs. Capcom Infinite, and it's been replaced with generic kind of epic movie score sounding themes. And while that might sound good, quote unquote, from certain standpoints, it just, you listen to the themes that they had previously and it doesn't work. And so that's a completely different issue, but one that I had to touch on there.
Mm-hmm. For me, as far as Injustice 2 goes, the reason I didn't give it a nomination is obviously I didn't play it. And the reason I didn't play it is because I knew there was going to be a Game of the Year edition and I waited.
That's true too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I reviewed it, and my excuse basically is Injustice 2 was a good release that got buried under a lot of great releases.
Hmm.
Like, we had a really solid year in gaming in 2017, and there were so many good quality releases that it's just sort of a matter of which ones are you gonna have to sacrifice.
Yeah, it didn't really stand out, you know.
Yeah. And I think WB could have done a lot more for Injustice's case by actually supporting the game at the community level. You've got Tekken with your Tekken World Tour. You have Street Fighter and Marvel vs. Capcom getting the Capcom Pro Tour and Battle for the Stones. That's something that I think WB has to get into and really support NetherRealm in putting forth these community efforts to support their games after release, rather than just focusing on post-release content on a broader scale. I cannot understate how much Capcom Pro Tour, Battle for the Stones, things like that have done for Capcom's fighting games, or that the Tekken World Tour did for Tekken 7. And so that needs to be a constant thing with publishers as the fighting game community grows and grows and grows. Yes, you have a lot of grassroots events. You have a lot of grassroots events that have grown into majors, Evo being the biggest example of that. But the company has to get involved somewhere too. And we're not really seeing that from WB. And I think that's kind of kept NetherRealm titles from being everything they could possibly be.
Yeah, though we see a lot of single player content as being like a big focus for NetherRealm's games since last gen started.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that kind of helps them set them apart from, you know, Street Fighter, Marvel vs. Capcom, Tekken, all them. Even though Tekken does a good job with that stuff most of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my opinion from the outside looking in, I don't play fighting games much anymore, but between the ages of 13 and 22, they were definitely up there as one of my main genres. And then after Street Fighter 4 came out, I just stopped because I just flat out lost interest with the way the community was becoming. And I know that it's gained back some steam after Street Fighter 5, but I feel like the focus with these fighting games has been all over the place. You know, you have companies that are focusing on, you know, just your average gamer, and then you have a lot of them that are totally community driven. And sometimes, like, especially when you're like not really a part of the community anymore, it doesn't really feel like you belong. And that's just the way I feel about fighting games in general now. But when I talk to people about Injustice, it's crazy because this is the only fighting game where people will say, you know what, I think I want to buy that game because I want to see how the story turns out. Like, you never hear anybody talk about the story with any other fighting game.
Well, you kind of did with Tekken 7, I would say.
Okay. But yeah, that's some interesting stuff. So I mentioned a game that, you know, nobody really put on their lists. But yeah, let's go ahead and move on to
That was a good discussion.
Yeah, it's great. Let's go ahead and move on to games that didn't necessarily make our top 10, but were definitely games that we liked. So let's just go ahead and go down the list of people here. I'm going to start with Teresa, since I haven't heard from her in a while.
Sure. This is not everybody's cup of tea, but I have I've always loved me some Street Pass games on the 3DS. So Miitopia didn't make my list, but I definitely enjoyed it. I haven't finished it yet, so it's another, you know, one of those, you can't really put it on the list, because it's really, it's an RPG, it's with your Miis, and the interaction between them is really cool, and even the villains are Miis. So, you know, if you have Voldemort, he could end up being a villain in here.
I actually played some Miitopia at Comic-Con, and it was totally hilarious. Like, the bad guy was like Iwata or like Reggie, and I was like, oh shit, I'm killing Nintendo's people here.
That's funny that they did it that way. But it's you know, it's a great little light version of a JRPG, really. So that one didn't make my list, but I enjoyed it. I guess if I had to pick a second one, probably South Park: The Fractured Butthole. That was also amusing, a little annoying at times, but overall it was a pretty good game.
That one was actually knocked off of my list.
Was it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, honorable mention things. As far as an honorable mention, the DLC that they're doing for Civilization VI, you know, it's not necessarily, they do have an expansion coming in February. But they have really added some great scenarios and new leaders, and that's definitely caught my attention and caught some of my gameplay as well.
Okay. Something I do see on your list is Animal Crossing Pocket Camp, which you actually just reviewed.
Yeah. Yeah, that one, it's a mixed bag for me because I see how it could be so great as a mobile game, but I am scared shitless that Nintendo is going to try to relegate Animal Crossing to simply being a mobile game now and not give us a true, fully featured console or handheld game.
I don't think they have that in them.
Really? You don't think they're going to do that?
I don't think they have it in them to dedicate any franchise to a platform they don't own.
That's a damn fine point.
Yeah, and then, remember, this is Nintendo you're talking about here.
It is, and they are loyal as hell to their hardware, and, you know, rightfully so. Either they make pretty solid hardware that doesn't fail. Red Circle of Death.
If anything, what they're going to do is use their mobile games as bait to get people to buy their consoles and console versions of games.
Yeah, that could do it. And Pocket Camp could absolutely get people hooked who have not gone out and bought, you know, New Leaf, Animal Crossing New Leaf. So this could drive sales to their existing games that are older. You know, because if you get your aunt hooked on it, it's like, come on, play with me. So you could come and water my garden and, you know, you could help me get into Shovel Strike Quarry and all this other stuff. I could see that happening. And then she could say, well, I want to do more than just this, because there is a lack of collecting, really, in the game. And it gets grindy, where you're just going and you're fishing the same goddamn fish and the same catching the same bugs. And I've gotten bored with it several times. Today I logged in just to get my bonus and to help other people get into Shovel Strike Quarry. And I'm like, ah, screw it. I'm done with this shit. So it's an on again, off again. It's I guess it's like I don't know. It's like that one thing that you just can't quit, even though you know you should. But it's enjoyable, but it's frustrating for me because I want so much more out of it. I want so much, I want full Animal Crossing. I don't want Animal Crossing Lite, but I can also appreciate where it fits in. You know, you're sitting at a signal light and you shouldn't play games on your phone while you're in the car driving. If you're not me, if you're not me, so don't anybody else do this shit, but you know, you're sitting there and you're like, oh God. So you could catch a couple things. You could, get one of your foresty friends to send you on some inane, stupid quest. And you know, there's a place for it when, you know, you don't want to pop out a 3DS or 2DS, or, you know, well, we would hope a Switch eventually. So yeah, it did make my top five, and it's mostly because I'm pretty hard up for an Animal Crossing fix.
Yeah, I mean, like, one thing I never realized with the Animal Crossing community was that with the more hardcore Animal Crossing games, like New Leaf, like, there's, like, formulas or something in order to, like, get a specific animal to your town.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah,
oh, hell
like,
yeah.
I never realized that was a thing until I like dove deeper into it. But the thing about Animal Crossing Pocket Camp, and remember, as you all know, my full-time job is in the mobile gaming industry. A lot of us were actually really, really excited for Nintendo because Animal Crossing on mobile has the potential to make more than a gold mine. Whether that be through, you know, whatever microtransactions you can think of. But with the way that game is designed and with the way their community is, there's really no reason why it shouldn't be a mobile gold mine, and the only reason it's not is because Nintendo is Nintendoing it. They don't want to make it specifically for mobile, and it's perfect for it. So I totally understand what Pat's talking about, where, you know, they won't want to totally go all in unless they know they own that market. But that's just Nintendo being Nintendo there. But I don't know. For me, there's a whole lot of potential here. I'm not going to go too much into how, but one of the reasons why I like Pocket Camp so much is because you can, like, level up your relationship with the animals there. And I was like, that is something that would totally breathe new life into the current Animal Crossing form. So
yeah. Yeah, there is. And, you know, getting to the higher levels of relationship with them, you have to really jump through some hoops. So there is a ramp up in difficulty as far as that's concerned. Mm-hmm. So it does have some challenges. It's not, when I say it's Animal Crossing Lite, I don't mean that it's some skinny game that has nothing to it. They've already expanded it quite a bit. And I could see that they could do so much more with it going forward, like maybe adding some fossil hunting, bring in Red so he could sell you some fake paintings, you know, that kind of stuff.
Awesome. So yeah, well, what about you, Chris? What game should have gotten more attention?
I will choose my number three game, which is Nex Machina. One of the two games that Housemarque put out this year, and sort of one of their final, as they said, one of their final games in the sort of arcade shooter genre. And it's a game that kind of just nails everything it's going for in such a way that it's just a ton of fun to play. And it makes a lot of sense that they worked with Eugene Jarvis on that game. And it totally feels like, hey, what if we put our spin on Robotron, sort of the same way that Resogun was, hey, what if we put our spin on crap, what's the game that's based on?
Defender,
yeah. And sort of have their flashy voxel kind of graphics onto it. But actually adds a lot more to it, sort of in Nex Machina. there's sort of an encouragement to, you know, explore the little bits of environments, because there are hidden power-ups and score bonuses and such, and you'll find some like secret exits to these little bonus levels, things like that that you're encouraged to go do, as well as just taking out the enemies, sort of being able to just sort of explore and learn all the ins and outs of some of these levels. And then you get to the boss fights where everything kind of changes up as you are taking on a boss fight who's doing different things than just what the normal levels do. And it's just a really well done game that is something that people should be checking out if they're into arcade shooters, because I think it's one of the best that's out there that probably matches up with Resogun really well. And says a lot that they both come from the same developer. And yeah, for another game that was on my top 10, I will go for What Remains of Edith Finch. So this is the newest game from Giant Sparrow, who did The Unfinished Swan, which was on the PS3, Vita, PS4, I think PC as well. They were initially in sort of a journey, like that game company kind of deal with Sony, is sort of a, you know, you come with us, work with, I think, Santa Monica Studio, and sort of an incubation kind of program, sort of work on your games with us, it'll be exclusive. But this was the one where they kind of broke out of that, partnered with Annapurna Interactive, which is sort of a new indie label that is publishing a lot of interesting stuff. But this game very much deals with some of the cool stuff that they did with Unfinished Swan, which was sort of having levels, some really interesting sort of levels to go through. With here, it's a story about Edith Finch, who is returning to the sort of infamous Finch house, where every member of the family that has lived in that house has died, often in either ironic or fantastical ways, at least as they are told about how they passed away. So some of the early stuff you see in that game, sort of you see a little girl who, I forget what her name is, but she is sort of sent to bed without dinner for doing something bad, I guess. But she's hungry, obviously. And so she just starts eating various things in her room, including toothpaste and like the fake berries on like a wreath sort of thing. Then sees a bird outside the window, crawls out there, turns into a cat. And as a cat, you are chasing this bird throughout the trees. Then you catch the bird, I believe. Then you kind of fall out of the tree, turning to a shark. It's just rolling down the hill in this forest, eventually until it gets into the water. And then
so
from the water,
this game is like an LSD trip.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
In some of the stories, some of the different stories, there's a really cool story with a teenage girl who is kind of a really famous child actress who starred in some horror movies when she was a teenager and ends up dying in sort of a, I think it's Halloween style, because it plays kind of the music like that. You sort of turn into this first-person sequence, like shooter sequence of running away from this guy that's like invaded the house or whatever it is. And it's just a lot of these really cool fantastical stories that kind of have some macabre style to it. Some of them are just really interesting things. There's one of the kids that passed away who had a twin brother live in the same room. He was very much into space and ends up dying because he tries to swing on the swing set real high and try and go over the bar. Ends up going around so fast that he flies off. And as the story tries to put it, is that he just kept flying into space. But obviously he lands on the beach and is killed. It's a really interesting story, just learning how these different people in the family passed away, as well as how it adds to the overall narrative of the Finch family. And there are some, and it ultimately culminates into some really interesting stories about Edith's siblings, who were some of the last people to live there. Her and her mom and her brother and sister, I think it was. And sort of it culminates into a really kind of bittersweet moment at the end as you see how things have turned out. It's a really cool story, and obviously won, I think, best story at the Game Awards. It was very much a fitting fitting winner for that category, because it is something that really, people should really check out.
So how long is the game?
It's maybe about 2 or 3 hours.
Oh, cool.
It's not super long, but it's
filled with all these... Edition? Sorry, go ahead.
It's filled with all these nice little story moments that you just play, so you don't necessarily have to go through it all at once, but it's good enough that you kind of want to just see what the next story tells you as you sort of explore all the nooks and crannies of these houses. Because when each of the people die, they kind of put like a little memorial in their room and then seal it up. And so you end up finding ways to get into these rooms through like sort of secret passages and all this sort of stuff that kind of makes the whole house kind of feel like a Addams Family kind of vibe. But like, there's this really weird house that has all these sort of secrets to it that you're not really sure where it's all going, but it tells a really cool story.
Hmm. So 2-3 hours, easy platinum?
Yeah. Yeah. There's no platinum.
Oh, fuck but this you,
it's easy to get all the trophies that are in it.
All right.
Yeah, like, I think the only thing I had to do any different other than just, like, looking at every nook and cranny and sort of looking at all the stuff that's in there is it asks you to replay one of the stories twice. I don't know why. But it's like a 5-minute thing. You can, when you beat it, you beat the game, it just lets you choose whichever ones you want to go play again.
Gotcha.
So it's like 5 minutes, nothing really that you have to do wrong.
Okay.
But
there is
it's
a gorgeous physical edition, either out now or in the works, that I saw. Just a gold cover.
Okay.
Really well made.
Nice. All right, Pat, so let me guess. The game you'll talk about is the game that rhymes with Rails in the Pie the Turd.
That's one of them, yeah. it's pretty low on my list. The Legend of Heroes, Trails in the Sky the Third. It's not the best example of a Trails game, but if you find yourself becoming a fan of the previous two titles, then it is a very good exercise in world building that you won't want to miss.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I would be remiss not to put it on my top 10 list for 2017. The fact that we even got this game was kind of a long shot, so major props to Exceed for making it happen. The closest comparison I could make would be something like Grandia Extreme, but I don't think that would be fair to it, because it would completely shortchange the game's strong suits, which are many. But it is kind of a dungeon crawler offshoot of the Trails franchise that may hit or miss with some players, and there's no denying that. But I really just I feel like it's a great experience overall, and not something that you should play just as your first Trails game by any means, but something that is thoroughly enjoyable for what it is. You know, once you have that initial experience under your belt with the series. So I just couldn't get through my top 10 without including that.
For what it is, it actually is a wonderfully crafted game.
Yes. It's what Falcom does.
The main thing is that it's mainly there for you if you were a fan of the series or that trilogy in general. I actually haven't finished it yet, but I'm pretty damn near the finish. And from what I could tell, it pretty much I sort of want to say closes the doors on that part of the story.
On the Liberal Arc,
yeah.
Ties up all the loose ends, dots the I's, crosses the T's. Mm-hmm. And again, it's just a really good exercise in world building.
At least until we see them show up in Cold Steel, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I've already seen plenty of art for Cold Steel 3 and 4, and I'm excited.
Yeah.
But, it's not the best Trails game by any stretch, but if you get through the first two games, you pretty much have to partake.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the two games I was going to talk about. The other one I wanted to bring up was something that almost got Game of the Year consideration from me, and that was Final Fantasy XIV Stormblood. What it does, it does the usual expansion thing of growing the game world and giving you a nice big chunk of game to really get into if you've maybe not played in a while or just need something to rejuvenate your enthusiasm for the game. But it also did a lot in the way of varying up the things that there is to do in Hydaelyn, and that can't be understated because it was already a very rich environment. And once they added things like underwater environments and stuff like that, there's a whole other facet to all the maps now. And yeah, there's a lot they can still do just with the content that's in Stormblood to last us the next 2 years until the next expansion comes out. And Final Fantasy XIV, Stormblood just continues making it one of those games that you wish more people could appreciate. I can't go into great detail about it because pretty much everything that you talk about now is a spoiler of some sort or another. But I would promise anyone listening to this podcast that if you get a hold of the complete edition and just start from the top, start from A Realm Reborn, you will not regret it. This has been one of the best gaming experiences of my life, and it's an ongoing masterpiece.
And I know that they have a thing going on for people that have lapsed subs. It's a free login thing, so anybody that has at least like 4 consecutive days, they can log in anytime from now until I think the first week of January. So people that have missed stuff, they can hop right back in, play for a bit, or pick up one of the expansions if they haven't gotten that yet and get a free 30 days.
Yep.
Yeah, I've actually been tempted to go ahead and pick up that complete edition, but
let us know.
I just can't play a game with monthly fees, man.
That was a hill I had a really hard time getting over for the longest time, but once I got there, I understood where the money was going, and this is absolutely the best subscription experience I've ever had. Gotcha. So those are my picks.
Cool. Brandon?
Yeah, so I'm going to go ahead and pick my pick, which was I can't remember what placement it is on, but it's Night in the Woods. Night in the Woods is so high on my list, mostly because it spoke to me on a personal manner. That game is basically all about growing, coming back after being gone a while to a small town that is basically decaying before your eyes. It's all about being sort of part of the modern lost generation, where, you're growing up in the midst of economic downturn and, social change and, the death of the small town as an institution, the death of old industries being replaced by new ones if they're lucky, It's about mental illness. It's about arrested development. About really overall the concept of change itself. And, you know, ultimately, as much as we try to avoid it, it is inevitable. And we all sort of have to learn to deal with it in our own individual ways. Also, it has probably one of the best soundtracks of any game I've ever heard, period. There is a reason that there are so many cover versions of so many songs from this game that you can find on YouTube, because it's genuinely good. Also, it's just genuinely unbelievably funny at certain places. Just, there are so many meme-tastic points in that game that I would be here for over an hour trying to describe them all. Also, it just had a really charming art style.
That's been ripped off constantly.
Yeah.
By big companies and like small fan artists that like, oh, I'm just gonna use your art style, make my own stuff and sell. Is that okay? And Scott yeah. Benson's been like, yeah, no. I have to step yeah. down on that.
Yeah. And also it's just really well written. It's got a nice little story arc to it, and it wraps up pretty much pretty well at the end, and you know, just rules, okay?
How long is it?
It depends on like how much of all the different material you go after.
Okay.
The actual, I think, prime story you could probably do in, I don't want to say a few hours, because it really kind of depends on how fast you can read. And of course, there's different like paths you can go as far as story goes, so it's not a game you can do everything in one go. But it's definitely worth playing.
Yeah, I started it. I'm just trying to get a gauge of how much more I got to go, but I really love May's relationship with her parents, where it's kind of yeah. playful, but also they're like, yeah, you're kind of mooching off of us now that you're not going to college anymore.
Yeah, it gets kind of tense later on, just to warn you.
Yeah. Yeah, that game is kind of about a town like this one that I'm in,
mm-hmm.
Sort of a Midwestern town. He's from, I forget where he's from. He's in Pittsburgh right now. But yeah, that's like very much the kind of town that he's talking
it's
about.
Sort of it's, Rust Belt type of.
Yeah. Yeah, where like various industries, farming and all that has, you know, boomed back in the, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, and mm-hmm. has kind of died off as things have modernized, but not all of the town has modernized with it.
Nope. Yeah, but
like,
that was basically
that, and I like the rock band segments where she gets to play with a band.
Yeah,
you actually like try and play the music with it.
Yeah,
and it was a pretty cool thing that you weren't expecting.
Yeah.
Yeah, Night in the Woods is one of those games where I really wanted to play it before even beginning my list, but I just didn't come down to it. Main reason being it hasn't been on sale yet. I'm not going to complain about that, so yeah. Mm-hmm. How about you, Phil? You have two nice ones there.
Yeah, I do. Well, I'll start with the first one, which is Pyre.
One of those that I forgot about before I made my list, because it would have totally been on there.
It's one of those games where our staff would universally like, but it's only on like two lists.
Yeah, because everybody forgot about it, and that's.
And I feel really bad about that too, because it's a great game, and it deserves to be there. But it was just such a good year.
Yeah, it was. Mm-hmm. It was such a good year, but it's also the fact that Pyre has. Pyre's main problem is that it's when you bring it down to its core, it's a sports game. And, you know, a lot of people just kind of forget about those after a while.
Yeah, I mean, the other point I want to make is if you were to explain Pyre to a person, you can't do it in one sentence.
No,
you just can't.
Yeah.
No.
It's like one part American Gladiators, another part visual novel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, another part RPG, another part, you know.
Another part basketball.
Yeah.
I think it was Lee who said that it's pretty much NBA Jam with slavery. That's honestly a pretty damn good.
It gets a little off there. It's more like NBA Jam with exiles. So, you know, they're not slaves. They're just people that society has decided they don't want anymore.
Yeah, NBA Jam in purgatory.
Yeah, basically. So, that's my first pick because, well, it's a game unique unto itself. There really is nothing else like Pyre. The characters are fantastic. You'll get attached to them. You'll have to make some very, heart-wrenching decisions because, yeah, you're going to feel good that, you know, they got out. But you've also done yourself harm because they're no longer on your team. So you have to elevate another person. So it's a constant, it's not a grind because it's very enjoyable to do. But it's just a constant trial on your emotions, basically, when you start getting down to it. And that's, you know, compounded by the fact that Darren Korb's soundtrack is just phenomenal. Just truly phenomenal. I think it's his best work ever. So, yeah, definitely one of the best games I've played all year. And, if you haven't played it, do so.
It's half price on Steam right now, by the way.
Yeah.
Yep.
So,
yeah, it's one of those games people look at. It's like, oh, it's just a sports game. It's like, that's like 25% of what that game is.
Yeah.
Because you're mostly doing like the visual novel stuff, traveling around and making story decisions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And my other, I actually have another game that I want to pick, and it might kind of surprise you because it's Axiom Verge. Yes. I'm going to pick that for one specific reason, is that in 2017, Axiom Verge was released on the Switch. So
It stands.
Yep.
Yep.
It's also, there's a physical release. So, it's definitely a game that warrants a look.
And, a revisit.
Yeah, if you're on the Switch and you're looking for a Metroid game,
don't wait for Nintendo to do it because you're going to be waiting for a long time.
Yeah, so get on that.
At least we know they're doing one.
Yeah, eventually. It's like Metroid 4 eventually or whatever the hell it's going to be called. So,
for those that don't know, Axiom Verge is actually our 2015 Game of the Year. So that's well-loved.
So it's well-loved, and I'll pick it. If I could think of a reason to pick it every year, I would. But, I'm stretching it a little bit this year. So I'll give you a real pick instead, and that's going to be Bush Hockey League, or Old Time Hockey, as it was called. Basically, they just rebranded. I don't know why, but...
I was thinking maybe it was a trademark snarl.
Yeah.
Probably.
I'm going to have to dig into that, but I think...
Maybe get him back on the show.
Yeah. We'll get Mike back on the show, figure out what's going on. But it's a classic-style hockey game. It's hugely violent. Completely irreverent as far as the storyline goes. It's basically the sequel to Slapshot that we never got. So, great game. Pick it up now on the Xbox One or PlayStation 4 or a PC. It's definitely worth it, and they've definitely kept updating it as time has gone by. And, you know, they've been listening to the feedback fans have given them and making gameplay tweaks constantly. So, that's my actual real pick. Thanks.
I also like that they made an actual Slapshot reference in that one achievement where you get both teams riled up and instigate the goalie.
Yeah.
Anyone who's seen Slapshot knows what that's a reference to. As well as what was probably said when you do instigate the goalie.
Yeah, so 70% of my list actually did make the top 10, so it's pretty easy to pick what I have to pick here. First, I'm going to talk about Hellblade, Senua's Sacrifice. I actually just finished it a few days ago, and man, what a game. For those of you who aren't in the know about it, it's developed by Ninja Theory, who's known for, I believe, Heavenly Sword is what it's called, and Enslaved to the West, as well as DMC.
And they also did a certain reboot of a certain Capcom franchise.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, most of those were games that I absolutely adored. And Hellblade is just different. I wouldn't even know what I really classified the game as, because there's definitely some action aspects to it. There's a combat system that's actually kind of annoying, but it also makes sense for what it is. And at the same time, it plays like a walking simulator, because that's really most of what you're doing. You're walking and you're figuring out puzzles as you go. Like, if Braid had fighting and was in 3D, I think that's what Hellblade would kind of be, plus some, you know, psychosis. And the psychosis part is actually what makes the game rather unique. If you ever do get a chance, I definitely recommend you play the game. Play with headphones on, because the psychosis aspect is totally crazy. You'll have voices in your head thanks to where the speakers are, depending on how you have your headphones on, you'll hear voices to the left, you'll hear voices to the right. People will call you stupid, people will call you smart, people will call you dumb. It's just a totally immersing experience that I really, really enjoyed. And yeah, it's really short. It's about maybe 6 hours long. And the whole mantra of this being a AAA indie game, or I might as well call it a B game, is just totally correct. I mean, like, these are games that we've needed for a while, because the industry has strayed towards AAA for a while when there's really no reason to. I mean, look at our Game of the Year list from a few years ago when we gave it to Super Mario 3D World over The Last of Us. The reason why we did it was because in the end, it was just more fun, and that's the reason why we play games. So, yeah, yep. That's why I chose Hellblade. I think, Brandon, did you want to add anything? Because I know you played the game too.
Yeah, I will say about Hellblade is there were legit times when I had to take the headphones off. Because it was
too intense,
too good. Like, that's really all I can add, is the effect is that good that it can actually cause a physical response. So, hats off to Ninja Theory for pulling that off.
Yeah, Hellblade kind of threatens you with permadeath, but I don't know if it ever actually follows through with it.
It doesn't. Yeah, it's part of the game, screwing with you.
Yeah.
So the main thing is that whenever you die, your hand will become a little more raw and infected. And if that infection goes up to your face, the game is pretty much over. But I've died quite a bit of times in that game, mainly because the camera mechanics are pretty bad with the combat. But it's never gotten to a point where I was actually scared about what was happening. So... it's a good kind of fear to have, but it doesn't actually do anything in the end, which is totally fine, because I'd be pissed off if I'd start all over again.
Yeah, I imagine that's probably part of the sort of mental health stuff that it is going for, sort of having the fear of this rock going up your hands, you know, when it's probably not an actual issue.
Yeah. Although, you know, if they did do it, I said I'd be mad, but that would also be pretty badass, so...
Probably start a game and just die a bunch of times and see what happens.
I want to say if you hit like checkpoints, it reverts some of that. So that's how it sort of combats that.
So you'd really have to work to, you know, kill yourself.
I don't know. Let somebody's 2-year-old play it. That would work.
No, I wouldn't want a 2-year-old playing this game.
Oh, yeah, you know.
Traumatize them for life.
I mean, not really for the mature themes. It's just it's a little much. It's a lot of sensory overload here.
Yeah.
They wouldn't sleep again until they were like 10.
And the other game I want to talk about is E8 Lacrimosa of Donna.
Yes.
Man,
which was on my top 10.
Yeah. I didn't really expect to like it all this much, mainly because I'm not really all about the whole action RPG life, but man, what was the combat button in this game? Oh my god, it was awesome. And I've played other East games in the past, but I've just never gotten around to finishing them. And this one had just enough to just keep pushing me forward. The narrative was done quite well. The characters are all extremely likable, even though a lot of the ones you've met before in previous games don't really matter, like Dogi, unfortunately. So
he's there. Like, he just doesn't matter.
He's there. He just doesn't do shit. Is really the main thing. But yeah, it's a good game. It's well designed. Unfortunately, it had some problems with the translation, and that forced NISA to actually do it all over again. I'm not sure if they actually finished. Do you know, Brandon?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I think it's coming soon.
Okay.
It's and not honestly, gonna be for New Year's.
Honestly, it wasn't that big of a problem. It was definitely bizarre. There was one area in the game called the Archaeozoic Big Hole, which they should probably just say crater. But the fact that they're actually trying to fix it, despite the fact that it's been out for a while and has actually gotten its share of good reviews, is it's inspiring confidence in NISA. So yeah. I'm not as down on them as like other Falcom diehards are. But the fact remains, it's a solid game. If you're looking for a good action RPG, this actually might be the best one of the year next to Nier. So,
yeah.
Cool. Before we move on, did anybody else have any game they wanted to talk about? Because that's pretty much it for the games part.
Well, I've got one that didn't really appear, as far as I know, on any of our lists. But it definitely warrants some discussion because of how fucking crazy and groundbreaking it was. And that is Doki Doki Literature Club.
Yeah, okay. And I think the reason for that is because it just came out too late.
Yeah, but wow. It fucks with you in ways that I've never seen a game fuck with you. And by the time... by the time it's over, the fourth wall is just in multiple pieces off to the side on fire. And it's a free game. It's short. You can play it over the matter of an afternoon, but it's something that I would definitely recommend anyone check out if they like horror and groundbreaking narrative, things like that, because it really is in a class of its own.
I'm on about the third in-game day, maybe about an hour and a half through, and I haven't really seen anything all that great about it yet. How close am I?
Close.
Okay.
Very close.
Yeah.
Oh, you are so close.
All right.
Yeah, just play it and go with it. Honestly, we've talked about the spoiler alert show that we need to get going on sooner or later. That is a game that is absolutely going to deserve an episode because this is a story and I think a villain that is going to warrant discussion for years to come.
That'll be a fun banner to make.
Yeah. So I just wanted to bring that one up. It wasn't.
There is one thing about Doki Doki that you need to know, which is that... the reason Doki Doki is free is because it's basically, in a roundabout way, a teaser for their next big project, which is basically a horror game that's, again, and this is sort of what the things that the folks at Game Theorist pointed out, which is basically these characters are basically from another game, and that other game is the game that they're currently working on right now. And there's a lot of, there's like an ARG's worth of material to point you in that direction.
There really is.
But, I think that's it.
We just had to get that out, I think. I know I did.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, as we keep on saying repeatedly throughout this podcast, 2017 has been hell of a year, and... we've just seen so much out of everybody. So we're just going to talk about the big three and how they did this year and where they stand now moving into next year. And first off, we're going to start with the guys who are in first place. We'll go with Sony. So let me talk a little bit about them there. Sony is in first place, but a lot of people are fearing that they're kind of just treading along, mainly because their E3 press conference, they showed a lot of games, but we just don't know exactly when they're coming out. And to me, that's a bit
forgotten. Sorry, go ahead.
I mean, to me, that's a bit concerning. But when I look at what they've done this year, especially with games like Nioh, Persona 5, Horizon, they've been put in places where they have a really good shot at succeeding. Honestly, I thought Horizon was in trouble because, it it came out much the same week as the Switch and Zelda did, but it still made an absolute killing for both Guerrilla and Sony. And you also have games that did pretty well in Neo and Resident Evil 7 that, you know, got some units out of there. So as far as their actual releases for 2017, they're actually doing solid. VR is also a continuing process for them, and it's looking
like they're being so aggressive with that.
It's super aggressive. Like, honestly, I wish all this came out with the Vita, and you know that that wasn't the case. But it's good to see that there's a focus on that now. My main thing is that, you know, I wish I knew what was actually coming out in the first part of 2018 that I can put my money on. And at the same time, I do wish that we see more out of Sony's Japanese partners, because right now it seems that a lot of their properties are westernized.
Well, early in 2018, you've got Dragon Ball FighterZ, you've got Dissidia.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are some RPGs that are coming out around the start of the year. I think that's kind of where Japan's going to be taking over the release responsibilities.
Good point.
For quite some time. But it would help Sony greatly if they learned or if they remembered the point of a trade show.
Mm.
And in 2017, they really haven't. And so maybe they can get everything in order in time for E3. I don't know, but they're definitely hurting more for generating hype than they are in terms of actual hype-worthy content.
Yeah, Sony is a bit of a dichotomous company, really, because on the one hand, they're doing super well. People are buying their stuff. Their games are selling well. Their consoles are selling well. But they've just shown the same games over and over for the past 2 years. So it's like, what are they actually doing internally? Do you have a new IP that's in the works? Do you have your Japanese studios doing anything? These are questions that we don't have answers to, and it's kind of concerning, especially when we've got, you know, Microsoft, which is nipping at their heels. You know, they're being super aggressive, and Sony, in a lot of ways, feels like they're just kind of coasting.
Yep. It's frustrating. I am a PlayStation guy first and foremost, and it's just maddening watching this, because it doesn't look like they're trying, even though I know they are, because obviously the games are getting to us. But they need a Kevin Butler again, you know? They need someone to really drive the point home.
Hmm.
And they've been missing that for a few years now.
Yeah. And to be fair, I mean, this year they did revive Medieval. So, you know, I have to give them props for that. We won't see it until next year, obviously. But, there's that. There's the new Sucker Punch game that's coming out. So they've got stuff in the works. But this is all stuff that's coming from their Western side. You know, I want to see what they're doing, what Japan is up to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then again, the concerning thing is that a lot of the first party exclusive stuff is stuff that we don't know when they're actually happening. I mean, the one Sony game that I'm really looking forward to is Spider-Man, and we don't know whether that's going to be a spring or summer release or maybe even later. And at the same time, you have games like Days Gone, which look exactly like The Last of Us, and you have, you know, you have The Last of Us 2, which honestly didn't even need to be made. So I don't know where they're going. I also want to mention God of War, which also looks like The Last of Us and Uncharted put together, with Kratos having character. But I don't know, man. It's their lineup looks cool. I know I'll play them, but I'm not really excited about any of these releases.
Yeah.
I think the big thing is that we just don't know really what's coming out next year from anybody. Mm-hmm. It's like, we know kind of what's coming in January and February, but you know, Nintendo and Microsoft as well. It's like, when are your games coming out next year?
And the really frustrating thing about it is that, you know, Sony had a clear presence with Paris Games Week. They even have their own little thing with the PlayStation Experience, and we've learned next to nothing with both those events.
Yeah.
Mm.
But initially, like, I mean, at least in my opinion, what put the PS4 over the top was a lot of their decisions just stemmed from just logical decisions for gamers. Like, for example, you know, being able to share a game just by giving someone a copy, but you hated in that video. But eventually, like, I don't mean to put Sony down in any way, because clearly what they're doing is working for them, and the PS4 is selling like hotcakes, but they don't really feel gamer-centric anymore, whereas Microsoft is doing everything right. They're just, we don't really see the sales from them, because, well, I can't say that, because they don't really report anything, but it seems like Microsoft is making all the right moves. We just don't see the content yet.
Yeah, Microsoft has been really, really interesting this year, because they did launch another console, just like Sony did with the last year with the PS4 Pro. This time they got the Xbox One X, and reviews for that have actually been pretty positive.
Yep.
I'm actually very surprised that you know, people are actually liking this console. I shouldn't be, because it's basically like an Xbox One with, you know, a whole lot more power behind it. But yeah, they've been doing a lot of stuff that's been very much gamer-focused, or consumer-focused, if you want to be, you know, more general. They've got their Play Anywhere initiative that's basically bringing games to both Xbox One and Windows. They've got three generations of backwards compatibility, and they're the only console platform that can claim that.
Yep.
You know, it's very, very interesting to see what being number two will do for a company.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then they make some weird decisions, like our marquee title for the fall is PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, which is selling well, but everybody's like, yeah, this is pretty rough. Especially if you're not owning an Xbox One X, which I guess smartly they're bundling it with the X, like for the next week or so. Or even in case, like, if you get it at, I think, GameStop, you get like a $50 gift card with it. They're just basically saying, yeah, don't get this on the old system. buy the new one now.
Yeah.
You'll be able to run it maybe on medium settings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
whatever that means.
Yeah, we'll probably be talking about PUBG in a bit. But Microsoft is, I think they're getting to a good spot at this point. The X isn't going to sell huge numbers. I don't think they expect it to. But what it has done is really boosted the S. I'm very surprised to see how much the S sold over the past few months.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't report numbers, but they sold out with those $189 bundles for Black Friday and Cyber Monday. You gotta know they sold a bunch on.
Yeah, they even, like, I think it was Newegg or Target. They even included $50 gift cards as well as like a couple games here and there. So that's no joke.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a shame. Like the marquee title for the X was Super Lucky's Tale. Which is not good.
Kind of a bad idea.
It's like, hey, we got this platformer that looks like any other platformer and is just super buggy and not good.
Yeah.
Now, Microsoft did have one massive hit other than, you know, PlayerUnknown's Battleground, which was Cuphead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Cuphead was a massive success. Yeah. And, you know, it's good because they really needed that win. Yes. I'm not going to lie. Yeah,
they've not been good at developing IPs.
No.
They've had good ones that they just don't follow up on. Whether it's because they have weird stuff like Crytek wanted to continue to keep the IP for Rise, but wanted to partner with Microsoft for a sequel, and Microsoft said, no, we want the IP too. And that sort of stuff. And I think they even offered to buy it outright when Crytek was having financial problems. I don't think they agreed to that, so it's like weird stuff like that. You know, Sunset Overdrive did not do well, but it hit big with the people that bought it. And yeah, Insomniac basically went back to Sony and made, you know, a new Ratchet and Clank, and now Spider-Man. So it seems like that did not work out well for them. They just don't know who to partner with that potentially is going to keep coming back to them in the way that Sony has when they had, you know, Media Molecule with Little Big Planet and sort of came back and then eventually acquired them. Or, you know, they worked with Naughty Dog and Insomniac back in the day, eventually bought Naughty Dog, but Insomniac still continues to work with them, be one of their best partners, that sort of stuff. But Microsoft, you know, they tried to work with Platinum. That didn't work out. That sort of stuff that makes you sort of start wondering, well, who's the person here in charge of, you know, their first-party partnerships? And why do they still have that job? Because they're not doing anything that is growing their portfolio. Because it's like, I think Ori is the only game that's getting a sequel that was an original IP this generation.
Yeah.
And like last gen, the only new IPs was like Crackdown and what was the zombie game that came out real late that they're finally making a sequel for?
State of Decay.
Yeah, State of Decay.
State of Decay, okay.
Yeah, so that's got a sequel that's, I assume, is coming out next year. I don't know when. But yeah, like, why does that person still have a job if they can't find good developers to work with?
Yeah, mm-hmm. There's got to be some internal policy changes that have to happen there, because the sense I'm getting is that people don't generally want to work with Microsoft because they're very restrictive.
Yeah, because you remember the... what was the card battling game that they were trying to bring back? No, from the original Xbox.
Phantom Dust.
Yes, they were trying to do that weird remake that the CG trailer sort of suggested it was going to be, you know, focusing on story and campaign, and ended up being multiplayer focused. And they kept making different demands, essentially to do more with the game for not increasing the budget for the developer. So eventually,
I will say this. Go ahead.
And eventually, the developer kind of went under because all these demands and such basically stretched them too thin, and they could not keep up with what Microsoft wanted. Microsoft dropped them.
Yeah, I will say that it's not looking too good at Microsoft when their like banner debut is. Game that is actually multi-platform.
Oh, yeah. PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds?
Yeah. No, not that one, but we'll get to it later.
Madden?
I will get to it.
Yeah, it's on the list. We'll talk about it. So I guess that brings us to Nintendo this year.
I'm just going to make a suggestion. We take this and sort of tie it into the next segment because they kind of...
Yeah, might as well, right?
Yeah, because it was really the year of the Switch this year.
It was. Yeah, Nintendo basically cleaned up this year, and the Switch is the reason why.
Yeah. Basically, everything Nintendo promised this year that was going to come out did. That's
that very includes Xenoblade Chronicles.
Those were some big promises.
Yeah.
So not only that, not only did they deliver on the first party support, they had, because of the strong sales the Switch has had in general, third parties have been lining up. So
yeah, especially in Japan, where a bunch of third party developers have basically had to scramble to get into the line to produce products for the Switch because they honestly didn't think the Switch was going to do this well.
Yep.
And one of the reasons why the third parties are lining up are because the indies are eating their lunch.
Yeah.
You look at the eShop right now, which is in total shambles because we have no idea how to properly organize it. a lot of indies have already went ahead and reported that games they've recently released on Switch that were out on Steam for like at least 2 years now are already seeing more profits on the Switch, which is totally mind-boggling considering where it's going.
Yeah, well, Steam at this point is a dumpster fire. So, getting a game on Steam is not hard because of the Steam Direct program that they did. And that, of course, means that a whole bunch of crap is littering the store.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're a developer that's got a good game, it's just going to get buried among the flood of crap.
Yeah, unless you're a big name that can stand out. Because even their tools for curation and sort of trying to find the good stuff for you. Like, I look at that little wish list thing that's like, hey, here's like 12 games will show you these might be interesting to you. For me, it's just like, this is popular because you own too much. We can't find any threads here of things you might be interested in. I bought shit for like making YouTube videos or shit because it was cheap, and it just muddies my potential like taste profile because they don't have like any sort of rating system that could help them say, oh, you really like this stuff. It's just I own it, and that's the only like metric it has.
Yeah,
so it just says, oh, this is popular. You might like it, maybe. I don't know what. You know, it's really crazy the way they've tried to fix the problem, but fuck it up every single time.
The only way around it is to follow curators that you like. And
I don't have any of those.
Well,
it's all outside of the Steam ecosystem that I would find out about stuff.
Yeah.
And that's their problem is like you can't do anything in Steam to really find out about stuff you might like. Unless it just you have like a big Steam sale, like the winter sale, and you see like the big icons like, oh, what's that? Like that's the closest thing to like curation that kind of works. Because you're like, oh, that's $5, and that icon, like the little box art, like looks interesting. What is this? Mm-hmm. Versus like the curation or the wish list stuff or the queues, all that stuff. It's like none of that really does anything good.
Yeah. So it's, you know, not really too much of a surprise to see, you know, the indies doing better on the Switch. The store is much more curated. You know, Nintendo actually does some quality control, so...
Yeah,
for the most part.
There are a few games in there that really shouldn't be on there.
There's stuff that's leaking in from the Wii U and 3DS eShop developers that...
Yeah.
When you see some developers like saying they can't get dev kits, that, you know, the guys that made Cosmic Star Heroine, they're not, like, jump at it, like, we need this now or else you're not getting the game. They're kind of like, but we'd like to know that we can put this on here.
Yeah.
Because they're still trying to finish up like the Vita version from the Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm. No, one thing is for sure though, especially with what we're seeing with the eShop, what we're seeing with their successful staggered releases, which we didn't even talk about yet, is you know, if anybody is considering getting a Switch and they say, oh yeah, I'm just going to wait until more games come out. But, yeah, that argument doesn't hold any more weight.
Nope. Yeah. Nope. There's already
all of the games are out already.
They're all out.
Yeah.
But the one thing I'm surprised about is how fast a lot of their accessories are flying off shelves because these are way overpriced.
Whoa, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my god, right?
$90 for a dock?
Yeah.
Yeah.
$70 for the good controller.
Yeah, the controller you actually want.
Controller.
No, you don't want that controller. It's shit. Sorry, we had this discussion. The Pro Controller, it's shit for my little hands.
Oh.
It's shit for my little hands, but apparently Scott likes it. I don't like the placement
I was about to say, if you're interested in offloading it, I would be interested.
Yeah. No, he's, he likes it. It's not good placement for using Amiibos either. It's clunky.
And the one thing I do love about this accessory thing is that Nintendo is definitely enforcing the fact that you have options. I mean, you look at the Wii U, you look at the Wii. A lot of the games that came out could have been a lot better if they just gave us the standard controller option, especially considering the fact that you could use your GameCube controller as, you know, a method of play for whatever you want. Wouldn't make a whole lot of difference. You look at Super Smash Bros. And Mario Kart 8 being what they were on the Wii U, and then you look at something like Star Fox, which... absolutely sucks, mainly for that reason. So,
yeah.
Oh, no, it's hard to say.
Speaking of which, I am absolutely guessing that we're going to get a Star Fox Zero remake for the Switch.
That absolutely has to be a part of the Wii U evacuation plan.
And they're probably going to give it a drastic controller upgrade to do it.
Yeah.
Because they have to.
Yep.
And I'll be honest, I'll be perfectly honest, Star Fox Zero?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It wouldn't be nearly as bad if it weren't for the fact that the Wii U gamepad weighs is so goddamn heavy and unwieldy. but that's just me. You know.
Yeah.
Now we do need to talk about like the actual games that came out on the Switch because they they cleaned up this year.
Real quick though, I mean, like talking a little bit about Star Fox Zero. Stepping back a little bit, looking at Microsoft, the game that I've been waiting years and years for, Scalebound, ended up being canceled. And guess what? We find out Bayonetta 3 is in development for the Switch. I mean, Nintendo might as well fucking buy these guys. You know, it's
it's true.
It's totally insane.
Yeah, you saw the recently saw that the Platinum developed Transformers games have disappeared from stores.
Yep. And also that that Legend of Korra game as well.
That's what happens.
I think that was a mercy killing.
Yeah,
that's what happens when you primarily make licensed games.
Yeah,
is those are not permanent deals unless you own.
Yeah,
own the companies that bank those things.
Because eventually the license expires.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Stupid TMNT game. Oh my god. Wasting my time. But yeah, guys, the Switch games. Go ahead, Brendan.
So, first one, probably the first big one that came out was Breath of the Wild.
Yep.
Breath of the Wild. What?
I was agreeing with you.
Yeah. Breath of the Wild came out and it pretty much fucking blew over everybody.
Except Lee.
Except Lee, but Lee is Lee, so...
That game's also not on Brandon's list, but, yeah.
Well, it's not on my list because I didn't play it. Yeah, I don't have a Switch yet. I will have a Switch the day after tomorrow, but...
Yeah!
Well, technically, considering what it is now, tomorrow, because it is now midnight, but... Breath of the Wild, it basically... They went back... Eiji Onoma and company went back to... the drawing board on this one after the sort of what I thought was the not necessarily I thought that people were a little underwhelmed by Skyward Sword even though I loved it, but
I think people just didn't play it.
It's just possible.
Like the Wii, we're not doing the Wii
was already
right now.
Over.
Yeah, but
if you're not bowling, then you're not playing the Wii anymore.
Yeah,
yeah. The Wii fad was already over. Not to mention the fact that. As good as Skyward Sword was, and I'll go ahead and say that it had the best combat system out of any Zelda possible, despite the motion controls. The fact that it held your hand for 5 hours doesn't help it at all.
Yeah, that's true. And that ties into what I was about to say about Breath of the Wild. Breath of the Wild basically completely went back to the drawing board and went back to, you know, what Zelda meant, and it went a long way to sort of reviving the feeling of the original Zelda. Which is that you're basically dropped in the middle of this place. You're not really pointed in any particular direction. You basically can basically go and do pretty much anything if you want to. And the game is basically you finding out slowly over your own, under your own discretion, the various parts of this game's story and its various elements. And, you know, the reason it really blew people away is because it literally just, it went against the grain of what Zelda has been since Ocarina of Time.
Yeah, they definitely looked outward for inspiration for new things versus what they did from Ocarina up to Twilight Princess, which is look inward. It's like, this is what Zelda is. It's these semi-open world areas that have these linear paths that go off into these different distances, and you have your water temple, your fire temple, your all these different temples, like the same order or just the same types. And it's like, we're playing the same game almost kind of for, three or four of those games. Because you had Ocarina, you had Majora's Mask, you had Twilight Princess, are all kind of based on the same formula, though Majora's Mask has a very different structure, but the rest of it is kind of very much...
Yeah, they're all really cut from the same cloth that Ocarina of Time created.
Yeah, it was Wind Waker is the only one that kind of spread its wings out a bit and had kind of an open world. It's just people did not like the sailing, which, for me, that was the best part.
I never really got that. I thought sailing was quite pleasant.
Yeah, it's like, we're just going to go sailing, and look, there's like dolphins or whatever sailing with you, and there's a fucking typhoon.
We're being attacked by pirates.
And there's this little island. I'm going to go look what's on this thing.
I think the main thing was because the sailing took so long, but the Wii U version fixed that entirely. But the main thing for me, which made sailing not so great, was the fact that when you first get access to the boat, you couldn't really go wherever you want. You had to go where the wind took you. So
yeah,
until they were done holding your hand again, that's where it went off. And so that brings me again to the fact that Breath of the Wild just puts you in that open world and leaves you there, and it's up to you to figure it out. So,
yeah.
You know, you can go out, kill enemies, and they'll probably kill you because you only have 3 hearts to deal with, and they're actually pretty strong.
Yeah.
And but the one thing that Breath of the Wild is going to remain unique to me and maybe all of us for is the fact that you could do just so much. I mean, when the game first came out, I'm pretty sure you've all seen, like, various people, various websites just posting about all the different things you can do. Like, you have big sites like GameSpot and IGN and Kotaku posting about the fact that, oh, you can, like, ride your rock to some sort of random place and other nuances in gameplay that really have no bearing to the actual game, but the fact that you could do it remained impressive.
Yeah, that's actually part of the appeal of the...
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, that's actually kind of what the appeal of the original Zelda was. That sort of feeling of where you had, it was completely open to you, and to really understand all of it, it was kind of a cooperative effort to explore everything in the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then in my, like, 50,000 page review, I mean, the main thing I talked about was the fact that exploration was just so broad. It was one of the few times where I could honestly say, oh, if you see that, you can go there. And climbing made that so amazing to experience. Just, you know, I hate climbing in just about every game, but Zelda made it different, and you'd think I'd hate it more because climbing requires, like, your energy bar to be to a certain high point, but it felt like a true accomplishment once you just got over that hill and saw what else you had to discover.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm going to, I think, be probably the only critical voice on this podcast, because while I love the exploration elements of it, I love the concepts that they have behind it. I feel like Breath of the Wild just needed to get out of its own way. The amount of resource management that you have to do in this game, the fact that the weapons are basically useless after 5 minutes, it's kind of like, it's basically the opposite of Horizon, where you'll get to a point where you're not really worried about it, whereas Breath of the Wild, resources are something you always have to pay attention to. And it seems to me like if they maybe had taken a bit more time and just cleaned the interface up a little bit, gotten rid of some of those rougher edges, it would have been even better than the game turned out to be.
Yeah, there's no reason why they should not have sort of gone back and sort of reworked the inventory interface, yeah. And allowed that to be easier to sort of switch between stuff that isn't just your, you know, main weapons, and sort of have that be more accessible in the menus as well as out of the menus. Mm-hmm. Sort of the same way they have some of the other items.
Yeah, I mean,
especially when they're adding a bunch of stuff with the DLC.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The weapon stuff didn't really bother me so much. Like, yeah, eventually everything breaks and shit like that. But as long as you were doing the shrines, you'd always find, like, a weapon to have as a backup. Maybe you were even, like, saving one of your better ones to use for later. Because when I played through the game, I didn't realize there was a point in the game in which you could have more slots for your weapons. I actually went through the entire thing having only 4 to choose from. So,
so
I don't
know. You never upgraded it?
I never upgraded it at all because I didn't know it was there.
That was,
again,
like, one of the first things I did, that and stamina.
Yeah, I guess I just didn't explore that one town too much. But yeah, like that was just one thing that I actually just plain old dealt with. But I do agree with Phil's notion in regards to the menu management, mainly because I was playing this game and Horizon simultaneously. That's impossible. Like, you do a lot of the same things, but the button layouts were entirely different, and you can't change it for either game. And that was just super annoying, because with looking at the PlayStation controller layout and looking at the Switches, you know, circle would be the main thing you use on the Switch, and X would be the main thing that you'd use on the PlayStation. So it was just totally confusing in that regard. I remember in Horizon, I was like jumping off of cliffs and hoping to use my glider, but that wasn't a thing. So
and it didn't help that on Zelda, the sprint and the jump buttons were right next to each other. Mm-hmm. You could also swap them. And it's like, this doesn't work that well when your default makes it harder to run and jump. Because that's like a big thing you do is you run off cliffs, jump, and then pull out your glider, sort of your maximum distance as you can. The way they kind of hinder that, some of the control layout is not great. There should be ways, like even with Super Mario Odyssey, I also think there should be ways to, rearrange things as the way you see fit. Because like in Mario, there's a lot of buttons that are doubled, like actions are doubled across two different buttons. It's like, let me put that, that's the circular hat thing where it circles around you, put that on its own button, things like that. Whereas here, it could have used some of that same stuff. Like, let me move some of these actions around to find a good middle ground for me.
I know Teresa's just been playing Breath of the Wild lately as well.
Yeah.
Because she just got a Switch. So yeah. What are your thoughts on this one?
Well, I did play it for a few weeks back when it came out. I borrowed it from the library and played it on the Wii U. So I actually, I'm almost at the point where I stopped because I've had to start over. So we bought it for the Switch. I've had to freaking start over. And I went about doing things a different way. But when I think about the button layouts and everything, and it is a little hard to remember how I was using it on the Wii U with the controller and everything, because that was like half a year ago. So I remember that it was a little clunky and I wasn't scrolling through the weapons like I do now. I was more going into the menu and then going that way. So maybe it's better on the Switch. Maybe, I don't know. I would have to borrow it again from the library and play it on the Wii U. And, compare it, like, it's the same week, probably, not just the same year. Yeah. But when I think about the button layout, I can't think of how to make it better, because there's so much going on. I know it's really easy to bitch and gripe about it, but I can't think of how to fix it.
Well, I guess the main thing there is that, let's just say that both Zelda and Horizon can learn a lot about how to improve just by looking at both of these games side by side.
Yeah.
They're similar in that regard. Like, I would say Horizon handles a whole lot better, but Zelda's idea of what an open world is in regards to discovery and exploration is a lot better in that regard. So, I don't know. It's a mixed bag between the two, and like for a long time, these were the two games that were the Game of the Year candidates for me. So,
and they came out 4 days apart.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, hey, here's these two games that you can spend dozens of hours in. Yep. Enjoy! Then they threw it in Nier like a few weeks later and it's like, oh, fuck you, assholes.
Yeah. So I guess really other than Breath of the Wild, and there were some other solid releases for the Switch, including like ARMS, for example, but the other sort of major killer app was, of course, Super Mario Odyssey, which basically cleaned up everywhere. Mario's always been in the forefront, but it made him a mainstream star. And part of it was because it just decided to do a bunch of stuff that Mario games usually don't do. It went back to the Super Mario 64 style sort of free roaming. Directed free roaming, I guess. It, of course, the possession mechanic, which just went in some insane directions that pretty much you were trying to use it on just about everything you saw, and there was usually a good 6 to 10 chance that it would work.
Yeah. It might not be useful, but it would work.
Yeah. And, for God's sakes, that stupid T-Rex, who... I mean, you don't even use him for very long in the game, but it's that's pretty much
first level, essentially, and then that's kind of it. It's like, oh, you just blew your load right there. On the one thing people are going
thing is, there's a bunch of other but the good thing is there's a bunch of other stuff that comes afterwards. And it also is the game.
The T-Rex actually appears in three levels.
Well, like I said, I don't have a Switch yet, so. And also, as far as story goes, it finally kind of put the nail in the coffin on the Mario Peach thing. I know I would say spoiler, but the game's been out for a while. But, that's not a thing now, apparently. Mario has officially been friend-zoned. Bowser, too, for the record, but I'm like, well, you know.
I mentioned it when we were talking about Sonic Mania, but in regards to 2017 and Game of the Year in general, you look at Breath of the Wild, you look at Super Mario Odyssey, you look at Sonic Mania, these are games that are arguably the best in their series. And when I look at every game that I've played throughout the years, the fact that we can say that about these three games means that you have to put them in your list somewhere if you've played them. And that never resonated with me more than with Super Mario Odyssey. There's a specific moment in the game which almost brought me to tears, mainly because, you know, Mario is pretty much, like, what got me into gaming. Like, Zelda is by far my favorite franchise, but Mario, I'm just a Mario guy. Like, I played through all of them. I haven't beaten all of them, but they pretty much speak to, like, why I became a gamer. And you look at that specific part, and it's like, oh, man, everything that we've enjoyed has all culminated to this. And it's like, this is an experience that, as good as it was, Nintendo will never be able to really do again, because it would just require another. It's the end of New Dunk City. The raid, or whatever the fuck it's called. And I was like, man, like that to me is actually the greatest moment I've ever experienced in a video game. And I did not expect it at all. And I was like, man, it's like Nintendo made this as if it was like going to be the last game that they've ever made. And I was like, this is totally intense. So. Yeah.
Also, there was that song.
Yeah.
That helped a lot.
Because that song is so damn good and catchy.
Right?
And there's a bunch of amazing covers on YouTube, too.
They also have different versions in the game. There's some areas where you can find a like boombox, and it's playing like the Japanese version. I think there's maybe another one. I don't know. I think they put out a soundtrack for the game. It has like three or four different versions of that song on there.
Yeah.
Most of us watch the Game Awards, right?
Yeah.
At the very end, before they announced what the Game of the Year was, they played a sequence of like every Game of the Year nominee, and then they ended with Mario, and I was like, okay, I think I know what they want their Game of the Year to be. it ended up not getting it, but I was like, yeah, that's the way you end the year, guys.
Yeah, like the first Mario song with actual vocals in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's a song about killer. It's a song. It's a weird song because like one ups don't exist in that game. You're gonna be your one up girl. Like, oh, those don't exist. Like, you can even find mushrooms in the game. They're not power up mushrooms. They're just mushrooms.
Yeah.
It's like that sort of weird stuff where they break so many conventions. Like, just getting rid of lives is a huge thing for the series because it's been one of its biggest flaws. Especially when like the Galaxy games. If you had more than five lives when you quit for that session, it got reset back to five. Which, if you're like right before the final boss, you got screwed.
Yep.
Right.
So that's Nintendo in a nutshell this year. To say it was a good year for them would be kind of an understatement. It was basically they had to do. It was everything they had to do, and they did it.
Yeah.
And in some ways, they surpassed it.
They also pretty much made all their promises, so that's pretty insane. Nintendo is still Nintendo. There's still some decisions they make that are that they make you want to pound your head in the wall and like shoot a monkey. But you know, it's I don't even know why
a monkey but, specifically? We don't know, but...
I don't know. It just happens. But, yeah, the Switch is an astounding success. I don't see them replicating the same success next year, but, you know, who knows? Pokemon and Smash, you know, could very well come up and, yeah, make it a different kind of force. So, yeah,
good job on that. Installed base is there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, they need to make a promise to improve the eShop. Because that needs it. Because I have heard from at least one eShop developer who's talked about how just trying to get a launch sale on their game for NOA and NOE, very different processes for it.
Mm-hmm.
One allows it, NOA allowed it to, where you had to change the MSRP for the game to what your sale price was, but it wouldn't show up in the sales section.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't necessarily know that that's a sale price unless they happen to get something in like the description or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like really stupid. And then like NOE apparently agreed to it, but then never did it.
Yeah.
It's like, this is really stupid when you've got these developers wanting to sell stuff on your console, wanting to sort of celebrate the launch with the launch deal, and they can't really do it.
Yeah. And therein is Nintendo's Achilles heel. They do not understand software.
No.
They make games really well, but interfaces and commerce sites, not so much.
Like what? Sales at launch? I mean, not like 3 years later?
Yeah.
Can I get you guys' friend codes? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
At least you can.
Just kind of wish that Iwata had been here to see the success of the Switch in its debut year.
Yeah. At least with like the friend list stuff, you can pull from other sources. So I can look at all the people that are on my like Wii U or 3DS or who I have friended on like the mobile games.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's least nice.
I guess that's one good thing DNA did. I don't know.
Yeah. So let's get on to PUBG.
Wait, I thought Dan Ramp was supposed to be hosting this.
I am. I just didn't know when to move on. Yeah. Let's move on. Let's go ahead and move on to PUBG's success. I really wish.
Yeah, Christian, I'm going to just go ahead.
I really wish Christian were here because he's the one that actually plays it the most out of all of us. There was a point in time where I did play it for maybe a good week or two on the PC, but that's that's a week.
I've played it a good bit. So it's PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, the third version of that game, essentially, because it originally came out as an Arma mod. Then he partnered with, I forget what they're called now, Daybreak on H1Z1, mm-hmm. which they made that game. Essentially, if you play it now, it almost looks and plays very similar to PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds. It just doesn't have the polish, which, really enough, for the H1Z1, that's kind of the main game now. The zombie survival stuff has been changed to a different thing called Just Survive. Has another H1Z1 branding. It's really weird what they did with that. They basically went all in on their like PUBG clone, even though it came out before PUBG. So it's very much inspired by Battle Royale, the classic Japanese movie from the 90s or late 90s where 100 people drop onto an island. They scramble to gather loot, weapons, armor, supplies, all that, and then probably try to kill everybody else.
Yep.
Or hide until they're one of the last ones and then kill the people in the end as the sort of the ending circles are progressively shrinking.
Yeah.
Sort of pushing everybody down to a final spot where hopefully you're the last one.
Yep.
And then it's winner, winner, chicken dinner.
Yep. I 100% credit Twitch streamers for making this game as big a success as it is. It pretty much took over Counter-Strike.
Yeah. And it's the biggest game on Steam.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no even qualifiers on that.
Hmm.
Yeah, like, continually breaks the records for most concurrent players, which is a crazy thing to think about for a game that wasn't technically out yet.
Yeah, it's not even finished.
It just came out the 20th. So that was last Wednesday, or yeah, this past Wednesday.
Yeah, the only other game I can think of that's actually done that is Minecraft. So yeah,
which
that in itself is another revolution. So.
Yeah, that was also pretty crazy, especially because like the original thing was just all the creative mode. What is essentially creative mode right now? Where, it's just, hey, here's all the blocks. You can place them and build stuff. Mm. Now, obviously, mods have taken over that. They have this whole weird in-game economy now that is all based on these Minecraft coins that you can buy third-party worlds that have like specific like games in them and all that, as well as like costumes and all of that are like user-created. Mm-hmm. In a sense, it's really weird.
Yeah.
But yeah, that game sold really well because it was a really good idea for a game.
I mean, like, I wouldn't say that PUBG supplanted CS in any way, but what mesmerizes me is the fact that the idea behind PUBG was never done before. I mean, I'm sure we had the hardware and software for it, but it just never came up until now, I guess. So.
Yeah, it's a really good idea. It is a really good tool for story making. Mm-hmm. Because I've told like the story about how I got into the top 10 by essentially not engaging anybody.
Yeah.
Until I got to like the final 10, I got into a car, drove it around inside the circle, and got shot a lot. drew one guy out of hiding, where I promptly shot him and then got killed right after.
Mm-hmm.
Like the most stupidest way of ending a match. I got to like number 4.
And for me, that's exactly what makes the game so engaging. Like, you guys know, I'm just not a big fan of first-person games in general. But the fact that, you know, you can just go in, almost do whatever the heck you want, and still end up in the top 5 by doing absolutely nothing, means that, hey, man, maybe there's a chance. I just got to get a little better. I just got to get a little better. I just got to play a little more. I got to play a little more. And it just becomes the addictive thing that it is.
Yeah, it's a game that is growing in terms of content options really nicely. The new desert map is pretty cool. Brings some new elements to the whole sort of Battle Royale concept, where you have these desert areas where there's less foliage around to hide in, as well as just having different kinds of buildings that are unique to that map, as well as certain kinds of weapons. I think they're it's kind of like, oh, this just has a different type of pistol. Sort of thing, but as well as the mantling is a really big deal, because one of the big problems, if you've watched any of the streams and such, is people running up to these like small walls or like busted up walls and trying to jump over and failing, where you had to kind of sprint and then jump, and that gave you just enough lift to get over some of these like broken walls, but just not being able to climb over stuff was sort of the biggest frustration.
Yeah.
Now they finally added it, and it works pretty well. I kind of wish they added the ability to do it while crouched, because it would be nice to have sort of a way to kind of stealthily get around it versus kind of having to, while I'm crouching, like hit the jump button to move up to your standing stance and then jump over it. It's still a little bit clunky. The game, very much for all of the good stuff that is there, it's still very clunky at times. The graphics obviously are not the greatest, which is probably more due to how intensive that stuff, like having all this loot all around the island, the different weapons, keeping track of 100 people, all that sort of stuff can be very intensive for CPU stuff. So, you know, there are people that have made, you know, brand new PCs with 1070s, you know, tons of RAM and all that in it, and it still doesn't run great. And that's one of their biggest problems, which obviously leads into the Xbox One version, where if you have an Xbox One, the original system, it runs like shit. And it looks worse because they're doing everything they can to get it to run better by essentially, you know, downgrading textures and all that. But yeah, its success is not really a huge surprise. It even leads into, you know, Fortnite's Battle Royale mode, which has actually grown pretty well. They had like a big 50v50 mode that they put in there, I think it's ending pretty soon. I think it's just a big test. But that is pretty crazy to play because it's like, oh, I won a match because I was just like one of 20 people left on my team. We just happened to wear out the other team. It doesn't obviously count as a win in your stats, but that's like interesting. It's going to be cool to see how other developers sort of integrate that idea into their own games.
Mm-hmm.
Or make their own clones, because I have no doubt that somebody's going to be able to make a game that looks and runs better than PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, but I don't know how much more fun it's going to be.
Yeah, it's going to depend on whether or not Microsoft can strike a deal in regards to making it an Xbox One console exclusive, because anybody can copy this idea. It's not like you can really patent this at all.
And which has led to Brendan Green getting really pissy about these other clones,
mm-hmm.
which is like a moment where you kind of have to, you know, slap him over the internet and say, you're making the third version of this idea you came up with years ago. You've cloned it several times, and now other people have that version of the game running on their own engines. It's like, you don't own this concept forever, especially when you took it from a Japanese movie from 20 years ago.
Yeah. And let's forget, the PUBG is going to be coming to the PS4 as well, but...
It would be really stupid for that team to stick with, go completely exclusive to Xbox One.
Yeah
exactly.
Because that audience there is half of what Sony has.
Yeah.
And obviously, they probably have a little bit of better time running it, because the base PS4 is more powerful than the base Xbox One.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not going to have the Xbox One X level of power, but I would hope this work they're doing with the Xbox One version on the three different platforms helps inform them a bit more about what they can do with that on PS4.
Yeah.
And because basically, you know, Brendan Green's not happy with Epic and Fortnite sort of making their own version of that idea, like, they can't let them just take all of those people and just profit off of them while they do nothing. That would be their biggest folly of, like, hey, we've got the biggest Steam game, probably the biggest Xbox One game when it's, you know, this point 6 months now, 6 months from now. Why can't we just go and take over the PS4 as well?
Yeah, that's totally going to happen. It's the exclusivity on the Xbox One was a timed exclusive from the start. So
yeah.
So,
and then that just goes into a whole weird thing with Microsoft not being able to just say, we're not buying this thing, it's only going to be exclusive for, you know, this amount of time.
Yeah.
They just kind of say, oh, it's console exclusive.
For now.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Or it's console exclusive for this preview version, whatever the fuck that means.
Yeah, but it seems like for the most part we're pretty satisfied with the PUBG success. But personally, for me anyway, if PUBG were to win like Game of the Year at a non-publication, personally I would boycott it. Mainly because I can't award a game that isn't finished.
No,
you know, why would you like? Let's say it actually did happen, and it probably will with a smaller publication. Like, let's say it actually does happen. By doing that, you're technically telling other developers, hand, it doesn't matter if your game isn't finished.
Yeah.
And that's my stance on that.
Yeah.
Now, I think the sales have said that. Because sold so well, it's essentially people saying, we don't care that it's not finished, we need to get on this game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and that's fine if you know what you're getting into from the start.
And,
you know,
which I think Xbox One people expected more.
Oh God!
Mm. It's like, no, you should have been paying attention to what happened on Steam.
Yeah,
because you're starting not at the complete beginning, but you're starting pretty early on.
Yeah,
you're not getting present, you know, PUBG on Xbox One X, not yet, at least not for a few more months, at least.
Yeah,
with far inferior.
So. Yeah, exactly. And that Xbox One version is just. The controls are just crazy.
Yeah.
They need to potentially rethink it a little bit, because they just put all of the things you can do on the PC version on the Xbox One controller.
Yeah.
That leads to a lot of buttons where they do different things based on whether you tap it or you hold it.
Hmm.
And some of them are... It's just crazy.
Yeah.
Like, you're looking at the map, and to mark a spot where you want to go, you have to press the right stick in.
Why?
That's weird. Like, I constantly hit Y because that seems like a more logical button to hit. That erases it. So I constantly, like, hit R3 and then accidentally hit Y instinctively and erase it again.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the controls just trying to highlight the cursor on that, it's pretty slow. You can up the sensitivity, but it changes based on when you're zooming in or out. And it's just really weird to try and do all this. Where, obviously, the PC version, you just move the mouse.
Yeah.
Move the mouse, you right-click on the place you want to put the marker, and it's like, okay, we're done.
Yeah.
Mm.
So there's a ways to go yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Then again, Fortnite also has that idea, and I just figured out, like, the other day how to do it.
Hmm.
I could move the cursor. I had no idea how to put the thing in there because they didn't really make that easily to see.
Yeah.
Mm. Which is also crazy in the 50v50 mode because you get matched into a squad of four. I'd see four. Like, what the hell is this? and it's not easy to erase them or anything like that, but, yeah, that stuff's really weird in these games.
Yeah.
It's a useful thing because you want to be able to say, hey, I should be going towards this, and it puts it up on your compass.
Mm-hmm.
But trying to figure out a good way of making that easy to do, so far nobody's been able to do it.
Yeah. So Nintendo Switch and PUBG were easily some of the biggest successes of 2017. But you know what hasn't been a huge success at all?
What is that?
Loot boxes and microtransactions.
Oh, yes.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
And let's be honest, this is something that has been bubbling under the surface for a couple years now.
Mm-hmm.
And it finally exploded all over EA's face.
Mm-hmm. And, like, to be even more honest with that, with 2017, it wasn't even EA first. I think the first really main big headline with it was with... I would say Shadow of War.
Yeah.
Anybody agree there?
That was.
Let's say NBA 2K was probably the first.
Yeah, like Shadow of War like had people talking, and then NBA 2K had people yelling, and then Star Wars had people jumping out of windows.
Yeah.
Would that be a?
Probably the scariest thing is that people don't care about NBA 2K doing that stuff because it's a sports game, and so there's a large portion of the audience that doesn't care about those games doing loot crates in exploitative manners because they're sports games. Whereas you do it in the Star Wars game or the Lord of the Rings game, all hell gets broken loose because you're messing with the nerd shit.
Yeah. I mean, I would say it's a little bit of both. I mean, with all three, you're dealing with a gaming community that can easily go extremely toxic. You take 2K, for example. I complained about it in an episode of the Day Zero Update. I put it in my review. One of the things that really pissed me off, and again, I work in the mobile gaming industry, so I understand why this kind of stuff is done. But using 2K as like my main example, you look at the fact that haircuts cost a good amount of VC, but you can't even preview one without paying? Like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, this is a cosmetic thing, you know?
Yeah.
And NBA 2K has a more casual audience that plays a ton of mobile games, so they're indoctrinated to that stuff from the start. Mm-hmm. So they expect to be able to buy some of that currency to pay for their cosmetic stuff, which then leads to that whole weird user-created stuff that they have in there, where people obviously copy real things, real brands, and all that, and then 2K has the audacity to get surprised by this. Takes it away from people, but doesn't refund their money that they used to purchase it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, oh, you just stole their money because they bought the thing that was, officially sanctioned by you guys because you don't review anything that gets put up on that user marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like, you guys are the dumbest people on the internet for doing this.
Yeah.
Especially when, the WWE games are full of that stuff. And they just know not to try and charge for that.
Yeah.
Because people are going to make their Gokus and make their other wrestlers that aren't in the WWE and their, you know, all their licensed stuff that's in there. It's, they know that just to let them do the thing and just don't, you know, mess with it, because then you pissed off the very loyal audience they have on WWE that somehow still keeps playing those games even though they're not that great.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem with all of this was the fact that Battlefront 2's loot box mechanic was basically tied to the game's progression. Basically, if you wanted to improve your character, you had to craft stuff, you had to play that lobby to get those items. And they actually had tangible effects in-game, as, you know, your accuracy or your damage would go up based on the items that you equip. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, that very much sounds like a phone game.
Yeah, and they charged you $60+ for that, and yeah, people were not enthused about this whole idea. I've also got my thoughts on the whole just cosmetic argument as well, because I've come to realize that the cosmetic stuff actually does matter, and it's how a lot of people differentiate themselves when they're playing these MMOs or online shooters, you know, and that's mm-hmm, why no doubt. They do that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I remember Tekken 7, like, one of the things that people loved is the Bullet Club shirt. It's like this dumb wrestling thing that people put in that game.
I got that.
It's like, oh, this is the thing I got to put on my shirt because it's fucking stupid.
Amen. Yep. Yeah. I want to make my Animal Crossing Villager have a Bullet Club shirt, man. Don't hate.
Yeah. I got a custom character with a Bullet Club shirt, so there.
There's that weird stuff where you can give them a gun. They can actually use that in the fight. It's like really stupid.
Yeah, don't do anything.
But... it sucks, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, it like makes you really vulnerable, but it's really fucking cool that you can have a fucking stupid gun in a fighting game.
Yeah.
And it's not like, you know, like Mortal Kombat when they have gun stuff in there. Like, that actually works.
Yeah. Yeah, barely.
Yeah. Yeah. Item attacks in Tekken are not good.
Yeah.
Nor should they be.
No. But... yeah. Mm. But, loot boxes were... there's been a backlash, let's put it bluntly. EA has kind of doubled down on it, it looks like, with UFC. I don't know if that's actually going to stand by the time the game releases. So we'll have to wait and see there, because that game went the extra mile of putting everything behind a loot box. So that was great.
Yep.
Yeah.
Just, wow.
Yeah, you want stats? They're in a loot box. You want a stronger jab? Yeah, that's in a loot box too. So, really?
I mean, prior to Battlefront 2's release, I would have gone as far as saying like it didn't matter and we already lost the war. But after seeing the backlash and what Disney did, or what Disney didn't do with Battlefront 2, kind of makes me think otherwise. But Battlefront 2 is still sold. Don't get me wrong there. So
yeah, well, it's still sold because it's got the Star Wars name on it. You could sell a piece of rotten feces with the Star Wars name on it, and that would sell. So
that's what they did for 20 years.
Yeah, selling stuff with Star Wars is not hard, but
not at all.
Yeah, whether Disney will actually end up pulling the license still remains to be seen, but I kind of doubt it.
Yeah.
So do we have anything else to say about loot boxes other than the fact they eat their guts?
Yeah.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I should point out that Apple actually recently is requiring mobile games to disclose the odds of the types of items. That's kind of
huge, because mobile's been like a wild west of this shit.
Yeah. Except for they're doing it tiered, like Overwatch did. You have to disclose the odds of getting each tier of item. I think doing the odds of each individual item would be a little bit unfeasible. So I think it's a step in the right direction, but whether it's going to actually do anything, we don't know. It's weird for me to talk about because, yeah, Dan, this is actually going to directly affect you.
Yeah, it definitely is. But I can go as far as saying there's already a plan in place.
Okay.
So yeah.
Yeah. All right. So we done?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I did have like 2018 and beyond, but I think that's better place for the first Days of Rocket of the year. But yeah, I guess I'll just end it with like overall 2017 thoughts. Again, I said it before. It's been a heck of a year. You know, we've had 2003, we've had 1998. I was too young for that one to even really say anything much about it. But yeah, 2017, at least for me, has been by far the most engaging and exciting year in gaming yet. Any of the games that we picked in the top 10 could easily have been number one any other year. And it just goes to show that our industry is just continuing to grow at a rapid rate. Most of us have been gaming for at least 25, 30 years now, and the evolution has been extraordinary. Granted, like we've seen games and companies go in directions that we wish didn't happen or would have hoped for otherwise. But for the most part, there's been substantial growth here and there, and it looks like we're in for the long haul with this generation. I actually just upgraded to a 4K HDR TV, and I'm really enjoying my PS4 Pro. And, you know, I want an Xbox One X, but I just can't fathom why I really want to own one at this point in time. But that can easily change. So, yeah, games are cool, man.
Games are fun. Yeah. So.
Yeah, we've had years where games have slipped onto the list because there weren't enough big names that everybody played. Mm-hmm. So it's like, oh, this person's top game that nobody else played had to make the bottom of the list because there wasn't any other stuff that's, you know, resonated with multiple people. Yeah. Which says a lot that we don't have any of those games here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 2017 was a quality year.
Yes.
Yeah. We'll keep playing those games next year because we've fallen all behind.
Yep.
All this stuff.
Yeah.
Cool. Anybody else have any 2017 thoughts to say before I close it off?
No, I've pretty much said my run dry.
Okay.
I think it's a year that we're going to be even more appreciative of as more years go by. I think we're going to be looking back even more fondly on the games that came out this year.
Teresa, Phil?
No, I'm good.
Yeah, it was great. I hope that we can top it in the next 10 years.
Yes.
Yes.
But yeah, that has been our end of the year podcast. Over the course of the week going into next year, you will find articles from every one of our staffers with their top 5, 6, 8, 10 games of the year and why they chose them. And eventually it'll all culminate to our overall top 10 list, which I am actually really proud of. The last time I felt this way was when we picked Axiom Verge because, you know, it was very deserving. Tom Happ has a lot of my money. I'm sure he has one of ours too.
Friend of the show.
Exactly. The games we've chosen are all very deserving. And yeah, there's some that, you know, we all wish could be on the list, but we believe that the method that we've been doing it over the past couple of years or past 5 years almost is the way to do it. And as Smashpad continues to grow, so will our opinions and our overall, you know, look on things. And I can't wait to have you all along for the ride. It's been an extreme joy. So that said, you can find this episode and episodes of Let's Weekend and the Day Zero Update on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Google Play, or RSS feeds. And that's pretty much it. I'm Dan Victoria, speaking for Teresa Sammons, Pat Mifflin, Filippo D'Onofrio, Brandon Perkins, and Chris Sologi. We wish you a fantastic year, and keep tuning in to smashpad.com.